I came to Pemberton chasing banality like a hound a rabbit, and found instead a lush, slow beauty so insistent and particular that it frightened me. After my initial visit to Tisch to scout the lay of the land and attend the interviews Charlie had arranged for me, I think I would have backed out of the whole thing except that by that time, Tisch had found a place for Hillary and me to live. "You have to come now," she said. "You've got to get that child settled down before school starts. And you've got to settle, too." Tisch was neither a fool nor a bully, and she had been a loving friend for close to 20 years. Tisch Griffin, my roommate at Emory University in Atlanta, always held that I lived, moved, and had my being, as the Book of Common Prayer puts it, in flight from my father. He was a squat, roaring black Greek who kept a small grocery store in the blue-collar section of Atlanta where we lived. And from long before my birth to the day he died, he drank liquor and embarrassed my mother and me. I remember the youthful anguish that his behavior and the snickers of my schoolmates caused me. But I remember loving him, too. "It's a classic escape mechanism," Tisch said to me one April night during our sophomore year. I had for a few months been going out with her boyfriend's roommate, like him, a junior at Emory Medical School. Tisch had been going with Charlie Coulter so long that their wedding was as fixed in her firmament as our familiar stars. But I had only met Chris Calhoun when Charlie's old roommate flunked out and Chris moved in. I had that spring evening announced to Tisch that I'd marry Chris in 3 seconds flat if he asked me. "Escape mechanism," Tisch said. "Get away from Daddy as fast and far as you can. And what's further away than Chris Calhoun?" "He's not worth you. He's too pretty. He's too rich. He's like a corrupted elf or something." I snapped back. "How do you know it's not my mother I'm trying to escape?" And knew in that instant that it was true. My mother was a flower of old Mobile society, according to her earliest bedtime stories, caught in a brutalizing marriage to a Greek god gone to seed. From my earliest memory, it was as if they had a kind of mad joint custody of me. I lived half the time in his careening tenure, loving him, and half in her kingdom of cobwebs, adoring her. He frightened me sometimes, but my mother made me afraid. To this day, she will not see it. For a short period of time, I confronted her with it. "You overprotected me to the point that I thought I wasn't capable of simply living in the world," I said. "It was always, 'Don't do that, you'll get hurt. You can't do that by yourself.'" "Oh, toot," she said. "I gave you the only kind of upbringing that matters in this world, the kind that makes you a lady. You can be very sure that Mr. Christopher Calhoun would never have looked at you if I let you grow up the way you say you wanted to, missy." By the time I reached college, I no longer took people home with me, both because of my father's drunkenness and my mother's by then refined Blanche DuBois act. I stuck fiercely to my studies and my sorority sisters, aping slavishly each tiny detail of dress, speech, and behavior that struck me as normal. In fact, I did not for a long time know what normality was. It was what drew me to Christopher. Much, much later, I saw that there was within me an essential, if deeply buried, appetite for outrage, for dangerous excess. But in the beginning, I knew nothing except that I wanted Chris, and he incredibly wanted me. He asked me if I would marry him, and I said yes. The first thing he said after that was, "Can I, for Christ's sake, touch you now?" And so the lovemaking began. There was no longer any reason for my pulling away from Chris except the real one, fear. It was my mother's longest-lived legacy to me. My fear was justified. After the first great stabbing pain as Chris entered me, I was lost, swallowed, drowned. I screamed for Chris to stop. I was utterly gone in panic. It had been this fear, then, that waited for me in my own body. Not the world's fears, pregnancy, disgrace. This one, the fear of vanishing altogether from the face of the earth. Chris did not stop. When it was done the last time, I began to cry. It was like dying. "I know," he said, grinning. "They say it is like that, when it's the best it can be." After that, we did it only once a night. But it was always something exotic and unimagined. I became what I believe is currently called a love slave, and spent the time I was not in bed with Chris turning myself into a perfect buckhead surgeon's wife. By the winter before my marriage, I was growing haggard trying to decide how to handle the matter of my parents. My father solved the problem early that spring by choking to death on vomit. He gave my mother the graceful cover of mourning in which to hide from my wedding, for she had behaved so baroquely and affectedly at the one obligatory luncheon my mother-in-law, Sally Calhoun, had given for her, that it was apparent even to her that she would not be welcome there again. My mother never held his mother against Chris. To her, he could do no wrong. After the beating started, the first thing she said was, "What did you do to make him that mad?" The shrink I found last spring told me, "You need to get away from her as much as him." "But I love her," I said. "At least half of her." "Then leave the part you hate and send letters to the half you love." "Do you want Chris to kill Hillary?" "He wouldn't hurt Hillary," I said. "He loves Hillary." "Andy," said the shrink, "he loves you. This is what Chris does when he loves." Each time it happened, he cried and begged my forgiveness. The first broken bone we explained as a fender bender. An open kitchen cabinet door got credit for the eye and cheek laceration. It seems incredible to me now, but I actually caught myself saying one morning, after he had bruised my stomach and thighs so severely that I slept sitting up, "I don't think any of this would have happened if I hadn't behaved like a whore with him." But I could not take action. And then, one evening in April, Chris wheeled his Mercedes into the driveway and screeched to a stop because Stinker was lying in it. And when Stinker did not move, he simply gunned the car forward and ran over his daughter's dog. There was a flat thump and a high, anguished, endless scream from my daughter. And then nothing. "Well, Hillary, look what you made me do. Maybe now you'll learn to keep the animals out of the driveway," he said. Hillary was gone and up the stairs to her room before I could move. "Get that dog out of here and bury him someplace, Chris. And then go to the hospital or the office someplace. You can come back in 2 days, because we'll be gone by then." He raised his fist and then lowered it. I did not move. I knew it was not I who deterred him, but the thought of Hillary, the daughter whom he so loved and had now wounded past his power to heal, past perhaps anyone's. And then in mid-August, two things happened. A letter came telling me that Chris was filing for divorce and suing for custody of Hillary. And Hillary found the letter on my desk and read it and took an entire bottle of children's Tylenol. The afternoon after I brought her home from the hospital, white and mute and listless, I called our attorney friend, Bill Kimbra, and made an appointment to see him the next day in his office downtown. I went into the coffee shop on the ground floor and ran into Tish Coulter. She had it out of me in 15 minutes and went to see Bill Kimbra with me, and in another hour had out of him his grim-faced assurance that the case would never see court, and that Chris would be a lucky man if I did not choose to have him jailed for assault, battery, and mental cruelty. By late afternoon, she had my promise to come the next week and at least see Pemberton. We did, and stayed 3 days, and left again. I with a job in the public relations department of Pemberton State College. On the Thursday afternoon before Labor Day, we rolled into Pemberton, Georgia, in a second-hand yellow Toyota Celica station wagon. In my files was a court order forbidding Chris to contact Hillary or me until the divorce was granted, and he had completed at least half a year of psychotherapy. We came into Pemberton itself, green and dreaming and somehow a little eerie, with its wide, quiet streets lined with the huge Baroque fantasy homes of the unimaginably rich Winter people who had come here with their servants and children and horses since the closing of the last century to renew themselves and play. "It looks stuck up," Hillary said fretfully. "Well, it isn't," I said decisively. "Aunt Tish says the people here are wonderfully friendly." She turned her head to read a sign. "That says hunting season starts next week. Does that mean people can kill animals?" "I guess it does. Some kinds," I said. "I hate this place," Hillary said, and for the rest of the afternoon she was quiet. On our first morning in Pemberton, Hillary came sobbing into my bedroom in Tish's guest house. "I heard the nightmares coming for me right outside my window. They made a horse noise, and their feet sounded not like they should." "Honey, it was a bad dream. That's what a nightmare is," I soothed. "Let's go look." There was nothing out a window. Tish laughed when I recounted it. She did hear horses. We're just a block from the training track and the stables, and lots of people ride their horses along the street in the morning. The street is dirt, That's why their hooves sounded funny. It's the ultimate status symbol in Pemberton to live on one of the dirt streets. It's one of the South's best-kept secrets, Pemberton is. I guess it's because the very rich have never needed anything except privacy, and there's a hideous lot of money in Pemberton, dirt roads notwithstanding. Don't knock them, by the way. Your new house is on one. I rented you the guest cottage at Pipe Dream, the old Belvedere place. It's wonderful, Andy, with stone fireplaces and porches all around, and it's cheap. It sounds perfect, Tish. Hillary will love it. It's just that Pemberton is not your ordinary little southern town, is it? It's very exotic. My God, it's so rich. It doesn't seem to me to be a normal town. I must have paled because she leaned over and pressed my hand and said, "There's nothing here to scare you. Pemberton's rich, but very comfortable and unassuming. Come on, Andy. Get Hillary and we'll do the driving tour, and then we'll go out to lunch at the inn." From the beginning, when Tish nosed her mud-spattered blazer into the streets of Pemberton, I was lulled with charm. Pemberton dreamed in a well of deep green as cool as a secret sea. Fine old oaks, some hung with scarves of gray moss, vaulted over the streets and lined long driveways. The Pemberton Inn was a rambling, deep-roofed clapboard skirted with stone verandas. Tish pulled her blazer in beside a low cream Jaguar and tooted her horn lightly. The Jaguar's doors opened on either side, and Charlie and another man peered out. "Not bad for a country obstetrician," I said, and he laughed. "Andy, this is Carter Devereaux. Carter, meet Andy Calhoun. Tish is my oldest joint friend." "I've been looking forward to meeting her," the second man said. His smile was direct and sweet, like a child's. The five of us walked into the inn. Inside, the big, cool lounge was paneled in handsome old carved oak. Hunting prints and equestrian paintings were everywhere. We were shown to a table. "Carter is one of the best estate planners for horse owners in the South," Tish said fondly, "as well as being one of the best polo players and best steeplechasers." "Is there anything to do in Pemberton that doesn't have to do with horses?" I said quickly. "Lots of dogs," Charlie said. "Hunting dogs, mainly. They're finishing up the Southern Terrier trials over at the track tomorrow. Carter's got a couple of terriers competing." "What kind of dogs are they?" Hillary's small silver voice said. Carter smiled at her. "Jack Russell's. She'll come out to the track tomorrow and bring your mother. I'll introduce you." It was a pleasant lunch. People came by and welcomed me and Hillary to Pemberton. The talk turned to horses and hunting. Hunting season did indeed open the coming week. I hated the talk for Hillary's sake, but there was nothing I could say to her in front of all these people. "You really will come to the trials tomorrow, won't you?" Carter Devereaux said to me and to Hillary. "There's some horses around the stables about your size." The sun came out in Hillary's eyes again, and so I nodded yes. "I didn't realize this was such big hunt country," I said to Tish as she pulled out of the lot. "Oh, Lord, yes. Some of the best hunting is out around the big Silver River swamp. Some of the world's great private hunting preserves are here. The big plantations. Charlie and Carter hunt at one of them, King's Oak, and it's owned by a Pemberton man, Clay Dabney. He's a darling. It's his old family place, and he and his son have hung on to it. Clay rents part of the woods to a paper company. A hunt at one of the plantations is something to see. You'll be invited to at least one." The next morning, Hillary, in a pair of Katie Coulter's outcast jodhpurs and boots, looked highborn and horsey and lovely, and knew it. The three big Pemberton tracks lay in the woods to the west of Palmetto Street. The stables were lovely in the blue early morning light. I loved the names. Dogwood, Runaway, Hand to Mouth. Charlie drove the Jaguar through the gates of Runaway. Its green and peach sign said Belvedere. "We'll meet Carter here," Charlie said. "He's got part interest in one of Pat Dabney's horses, and so the skinny goes, Pat Dabney." "You're worse gossip than any woman I ever met," Tish said. "Carter broke up with Pat Dabney 2 years ago. His wife died of cancer 5 years ago, but he's way past the grieving stage, in case you were wondering." "I wasn't," I said. "Belvedere, Dabney, who owns what? And where have I heard Belvedere and Dabney before?" Tish laughed. "Belvedere is the name of the people who used to own the estate where your guest house is. Pat Dabney, who owns Runaway, is a Belvedere. You heard Dabney when I was telling you about King's Oak. That's the big plantation out in the big silver swamp. Clay Dabney and his son Chip own it, and Pat was married to Clay's nephew, Tom. Tom hardly ever comes out of the Big Silver Swamp. He's got a kind of cabin on Goat Creek back in the swamp near the river. He lives back in there year-round. I think that's one reason Pat divorced him. He wouldn't move to town with her. He teaches English at the college. Everybody loves Tom, even though we mostly think he's crazy, which he is. We got out of the car into the cool morning. I breathed deeply, inhaling a wonderful mixed bouquet of fresh, damp earth and blooming flowers. Carter Devereaux came around the side of the stable just then, talking with a small blonde woman in faded blue jeans and a striped T-shirt and scuffed boots. She had the blunt, fierce face of a peregrine. Not beautiful, not even pretty, but absolutely compelling. Her body was glorious, slender and ripe and muscled. I knew that she must be Pat Dabney. Carter Devereaux introduced us. "Well, Hillary Calhoun, you're a pretty thing, aren't you?" she said. "Do you ride? I'd be glad to take you out on one of my little mares sometime soon. You and your mother stick around. Some of mine are just coming in from the track." She nodded again and strode off. "I think she's beautiful," Hillary said. Tish laughed and ruffled her hair. "And she knows all about horses and riding. If you really want to learn, she's the lady who can teach you." "I'd be glad to show her a little about it, too," Carter said. His blue eyes were warm on my face. We pulled the hamper Tish had packed out of the trunk and spread our lunch on the soft grass under a big spreading tree. Just as we were starting in on our sandwiches, a stable boy came out and handed Carter a folded note. He passed it to me. "Tell Hillary I'd like to teach her to ride, and if she'll come by any afternoon next week around 3, we'll begin. I join you, but Doodah has colic, and I think we're going to have to open him up." It was signed with a huge, slashing P. Hillary turned to Carter. "Does that mean they're going to operate on a horse?" she said worriedly. "Yep, but it's not really a very big deal," he said. "There are more good vets in Pemberton than there are doctors." "Charlie is a hot ticket with the Stratties," Carter said. "Who are the Stratties?" I said. "Well," Carter said, "Stratton Fournier, the folks what run our friendly bomb plant." I felt as if an immense, silent, white explosion had gone off inside my head. Of course! Stratton Fournier, civilian contractors and operators of the Big Silver River plant, manufacturers of components of nuclear weapons for the United States of America. Dear God in heaven, I said. I forgot. I simply forgot about a nuclear weapons plant. I had fled danger with my child and brought her instead into the very jaws of the place that some environmental groups deemed worse than Three Mile Island. I looked at Tish. You should have said something. Andy, those stories, that's media, that's hype. Don't you think we'd know if the Big Silver was a danger to us? There are 10 separate government water and soil testing stations around the plant, and about 100 private ones, and they test every day, and there's nothing in our water that hasn't always been there, or our air. I looked at Carter. Andy, I know the top brass at Stratton Fournier. They just won some kind of national safety award. Tish is right. You simply aren't ever going to know the Big Silver's out there. And abruptly, I believed them all, and the brief spasm of terror was over. Is it really okay? Hillary whispered to me. Yes, I said, it really is. 2 weeks later, we moved into the little guest house Tish had rented for us. It was almost dark on Sunday before we finished unpacking. Hillary's school began the next morning, so did my own job at Pemberton State. If you'd tell me where the stuff was, I'd make us some sandwiches, Hillary said. Give me 2 minutes and I'll do it. And then I said, oh, shit. I told my new boss I'd leave a copy of my resume on his desk so he'd have it for the staff meeting in the morning, and I forgot. I'm going to have to go over to the college and do it now. Come on, I'll drop you at Aunt Tish's. I left Hillary in Tish's kitchen and turned the Toyota across Palmetto Street and out the state highway toward the college. I had no trouble finding the lot in which I'd parked when I came for my interview. The public information office was just inside. I pulled the car up to the closed steel door and got out into the very hot, gray twilight. I found the door unlocked and went into a long, dim hall. I groped in near darkness the short distance to the public information office, found it locked, and slid the envelope with my resume in it under the door and hurried back to the door giving onto the parking lot. The door was shut fast when I reached it, and I could not open it. For a moment I panicked, pushing blindly at the smooth steel, and then I kicked it, and it jolted open, and I stumbled out into the dark and virtually into the arms of a man standing on the other side of the door. The man looked horrifying. Wild. A madman. He was small, hardly half a head taller than me, and his hair was a straight Indian black that fell over his eyes. He wore ragged, torn fatigues, and on his slender waist there was a leather belt that held a sheathed knife, and there was something strapped over one of his powerful shoulders that looked incredibly like a quiver of arrows. "Get out of my way," I said, and he stepped back silently to let me pass, and I saw behind him a mud-splattered all-terrain vehicle parked next to mine, and on the hood of it, the carcass of a deer. Its open eyes were opaque and glassy, and there was a beautiful rack of slender antlers on its fine head like a crown. "Oh, Christ, I'm sorry," he said. "I didn't think I'd run into anybody on Sunday night, or I'd have left him off at home before I came. Are you going to be sick or something?" "I'm not going to be sick, no," I snapped, "but you ought to be." He smiled at me and padded into the building. Inside, I saw a window light to yellow. A little Haydn quartet spilled out into the thick air. I got into the Toyota and turned back toward Pemberton. I picked up Hillary and chatted a moment with Tish and Charlie before we went home. For a long time that night, I lay with my eyes closed, seeing against the lids, as if seared there by a flash of lightning, the image of the dark face and the bloodied, stiffening deer. 75 miles northwest of the Georgia-Florida state line, on either side of the Big Silver River, lies the Big Silver Swamp. At daybreak on a September Saturday, a week after Hillary and I had moved into our little house on Whimsy Road, I sat in a kind of treehouse in the lower branches of a great oak tree on a small island in Goat Creek, at what seemed to me the very dark heart of the Big Silver Swamp, and waited for a deer to come by below. Carter Devereaux had brought me in the humid early morning blackness to King's Oak Plantation for Clay and Chip Dabney's annual Pemberton hunt. Brought me apprehensive and protesting. I had not wanted to come. "You really ought to go," he said. "It's the start of the fall social season here. Clay's been giving this hunt barbecue every September for as long as I can remember. Everybody in Pemberton you'll want to meet will be there." "Carter," I said, "I hate hunting and killing animals. I'm not sure anybody in Pemberton will think meeting me is a social triumph. Maybe I can get to know them another way." "Sure," he said equably. "I'll give a little dinner party for you sometime soon, if you'll let me. If you change your mind, let me know." And I did, for the simple reason that Tish came down on me like a duck on a June bug when she heard that I had refused Carter's invitation to the hunt. "For God's sake," she said in exasperation, "refusing the King's Oak hunt is like refusing dinner at the White House. Killing deer isn't what it's about. It's Clay Dabney's way of honoring his hometown. It's like a slap in the face to him and the rest of Pemberton if you refuse just because you don't like hunting. I wish you'd reconsider." I called Carter and asked diffidently if the invitation was still open. "Of course," he said. And so 3 o'clock this morning he'd picked me up in his Jaguar and we had driven the back pre-dawn miles out the state highway toward the Big Silver River and King's Oak Plantation. "Tell me about Clay Dabney and King's Oak," I said cheerfully, wanting to put my head back and howl like an abandoned dog. "I guess you'd call him sort of the village squire," Carter said. "He's the biggest landowner in this part of the state. His grandfather did a year at Heidelberg University, and then bought up about 10,000 acres around the Big Silver Swamp. But he'd done a lot of hunting and fishing in Germany, and studied some kind of woodsmanship, and had built a big white-columned house on one side of the river and a big lodge just on the other, and invited some of the rich Yankees and Europeans he'd met to come down. Before long, King's Oak was famous among hunters. Well, in due time, he passed the land on to his son, Thomas, and he kept the tradition going. And then Thomas had two sons, Claude and Clay. He left Claude the land on the east side of the Big Silver, with the house, and Clay the land on the west, with the lodge. Oh, and the trees, the big old oak tree that the place is named for, King's Oak? Clay got that, even though it's on an island in the creek that divides the property. Claude died of pneumonia back around 1950, and his widow, Caroline, sold the house and the land to the Atomic Energy Commission for use for the Big Silver facility. She moved to town, and she still lives there with her daughter, Miggy. Claude and Caroline's son is Tom Dabney. He almost never comes to King's Oak. Doesn't speak to his mother. Hasn't if he could help it since she sold the land and the house. He's a great woodsman, like his dad and granddad and great-grand. Oh, yes, I said, the hermit. Must be tough to live in Pemberton and hate horses and hunting. He doesn't hate hunting, Carter said. He just hates organized hunts. He has some land in the swamp. It's a kind of strip between Clay's land and the big silver plant land. Tom bought it from his mother when she sold to the AEC. Sold his car and met her market price. He stays up there in the little house and hunts his own property. Clay always treated him like his own kid, and Tom is crazy about him. He wouldn't cross the creek to spit on Chip. Chip, I said, that's Mr. Dabney's son, isn't it? Yes, Carter said, Chip, Clay Dabney Jr. He's about Tom's age, but Chip just never's gotten it together somehow. He's the apple of his mama's eye, and Clay loves him, of course. Chip is what is commonly known around here as just plain sorry. Clay has spent 35 years and God knows how much money getting him out of trouble. I know he loves Chip, but you can't help seeing the contrast or the look in his eyes when Tom's around. What does he do now, Chip, I asked. Clay turned King's Oak over to him about 15 years ago to manage. And he started the big hunts up again and manages the plantation, except for the part that the paper company leases. Clay just kind of closes his eyes to the people Chip brings in there and what they do. He turned the car off the highway onto a narrow, unmarked sand road that seemed to run endlessly through black woods. Woods so dense that in places the trees met overhead, and it seemed that we were passing through a tunnel. Abruptly, the darkness ahead of us gave onto a vast, gray-lit clearing, and I saw the King's Oak Lodge for the first time. It was enormous, with a massive two-story central structure of silvery weathered logs and a long front veranda. Behind it, a cluster of lower buildings lay like sleeping animals in the thin first light, and off to the left, another smaller two-story log building. A number of jeeps and cars and wagons were parked in front of the lodge. Who are all the people? I said, gesturing towards the cars. Most of them are hunters, already on the stands, he said. Probably some of the caterers and some extra help from town. By noon, there'll be tables set up on the veranda and about 500 people gobbling barbecue and Brunswick stew and drinking free liquor. The band will be down there at one end of the veranda. It's right out of Gone with the Wind. I don't know why it puts up with us, but he seems tickled with it as a kid. And that's just what I am, a big kid at heart, a man's voice said, and Clay Dabney stepped out of the shadows of the veranda. I've been sitting here waiting for you to get Miss Andy out here. I'm going to take her out to the King's Oak myself and get her set up. I looked up into dark, dancing eyes and a face as brown as a walnut under a shock of pure silver hair. I'm Andy Calhoun, Mr. Dabney, I said. It was nice of you to let me come. I know about as much about hunting in the woods as a geisha. I honestly never have even held a gun. I really don't plan to shoot at a deer or anything. Time for that later, if you should be interested, he said. The first time is for looking and listening. You ready? I'll run you out to King's Oak in the jeep. Carter, you go on. I've got you down in F. Good hunting. We got into the jeep and bumped down what appeared to be merely a sandy trail, leading into the close, pressing woods. We seemed to have slipped 1,000 miles and as many years away from civilization. It was a dark wildness that you knew had no limits, either physically or spiritually. I could feel the huge power of it pulsing gently, breathing like a giant, just-waking animal. I did not want to see this place clearly, and I did not want to be let alone in it. There was simply no telling what might come out of this primeval darkness, seeking this primeval light. It's very mysterious, isn't it? I said. I know what you mean, he said. There's lots of myths about the woods. My grandfather studied a lot of that in Germany. Mostly crap, of course, but you really can feel something in the woods. A power. I got stiffly out of the jeep and followed his outstretched arm with my eyes. We stood on the bank of a creek that ran wide and still and black. In the exact middle of the spread of water, there was a small island, and in the center of the island stood the largest and oldest oak tree that I had ever seen. It was as a fortress out of antiquity. Its trunk had the girth of an automobile, and it branched out low, its shawl of Spanish moss almost touched the earth. It stopped the eye and the breath simultaneously. There could be no doubt that this tree was the god of this place, the heart of the forest. Wildness flowed from it like honey.
"It's something, isn't it?" he said. "Live oak. There's not another tree in the Big Silver like the King's Oak."
There was a rough old ladder of silver wood disappearing up into the huge oak, and I said, "And best of all, there's a treehouse up there."
"I told you I was a kid at heart," he said. "Those are the steps up to the stand. That's where I'm going to put you."
He helped me up the ladder and into the stand. He handed the rifle up to me.
"Just remember that one shot will bring somebody in 5 minutes flat," he said. "And I'll send one of the boys for you around 11. Good hunting, Miss Andy."
"Good hunting, Mr. Dabney," I said. At first, I was fairly comfortable up in the stand, and the sense of all that green aloneness outside my hidden chamber was titillating. I sat as still as I could, balancing the gun across my knees. I listened as hard as I could for any sound that might be deer walking through the forest, and I did hear a few sounds, tiny dry rustles, the occasional call of a bird. But it seemed to me, as the sun grew higher and the morning wore on, that sound began to cease. Sweat broke out at my hairline and on my upper lip. I looked at my watch. It had stopped. That's when the strangeness began. My heart gave a small spasm, like a suddenly caged bird, when I realized that I did not know what time it was. I felt the panic coming like a wave rolling toward me, but I could not seem to move to avoid it. It broke over me like a cold, salt sea and carried me down. It had no bottom and no top. I felt the utter terror and awfulness of everything, of my weakness and inability to care for myself and my child, of my broken marriage and beaten flesh and shattered daughter, of the secret darkness within me, of love that wounded and killed, and life that hung over an abyss, and death that waited at the end of it all, of years and years of fear still to come, and of loss, and of aloneness. That was it. Aloneness. Aloneness lay outside and beyond me, wild and total and empty and endless. I would carry it with me wherever I ran. I lurched to my knees in a blind panic.
I would run. I would run through the woods to where the other hunters were. Then I realized that I had no idea on earth which direction to take, and in any case, I could not run back to the house because it lay miles away, through forests so dense that no road or path could penetrate it. I sat back down onto the platform and rolled over onto my side and cried. I moaned and sobbed, and for a time I think I screamed in grief and terror. I cried as I had not after Chris's beatings, after the death of the puppy, after the divorce. I cried for hope and help and pity, and knew that none would come. I thought then that I must have cried for an hour, though no one ever does, of course. When I finally stopped, a small wind had sprung up and fingered its way through the oak leaves. I looked down at the creek below. It was sun-dappled and still as eternity and empty. And then it wasn't. He came silently and without a ripple, wading downstream toward the island and the oak, and the canoe behind him seemed to glide on the black water without sound or motion. He was slender and lithe and dark, and he was naked. In the boat behind him was a large, taupe brown deer, a buck, its head hanging over the side. In the stern of the canoe, on the seat, lay a simple wooden bow with a sweet, polished curve and a taut string. The man pulled the boat to the shore of the island and stepped out of the water onto the moss. His body was beautiful. Muscles slid long and smooth in his arms and shoulders as he pulled the buck out of the boat by its antlers and dragged it to rest directly beneath the tree. He positioned the buck on its side and tipped its head back, so that the white throat shone and the dead black eyes looked directly up at me. He went on silent feet to the canoe and took a squat hook knife from the floor and unsheathed it, and walked back to the body of the deer. His genitals were full and perfect, and he was powerfully, fully erect.
He stooped and murmured something into the dead ear, and took an oak leaf from the ground and laid it in the open mouth atop the lolling tongue. Then he drew the knife slowly across the deer's throat. Blood leaped and fountained, and he was still for a long moment in his crouch, the blood spraying across his knees. And then slowly he reached down to the pumping throat and brought his red hand up and striped the blood of the deer across his face, chest, thighs, and genitals. He leaned over the deer's open black mouth and kissed it lightly, delicately with his own. It was a reverent kiss, a sacrament. Still in his crouch, his lips formed words. Thank you. He stood then, and I saw what I had known all along, that he was the man I had seen the week before in the dark college parking lot, and that in his eyes there stood tears. Something slow and warm and enormous turned in my groin, and I felt swimming and weak in knees and wrists, and thought that I might weep once again or faint. I closed my eyes. I heard nothing else, but when I finally opened my eyes, he was gone. I sat motionless in the waning morning, waiting for Clay Dabney's man to come and take me back to the barbecue. I had been right to be afraid in the big silver swamp. By noon, I was back on the steps of the King's Oak veranda. But the grip of the past morning in the swamp must have showed. Carter said, "You must have seen some kind of deer out there, Andy." "Deer my foot," Tish said, peering at me. "Ghost is more like it." "No," I said crisply. "I've been sweating. No deer, no ghost." Clay Dabney lifted a Bloody Mary off the tray carried by a passing black waiter. "I'm surprised you didn't see something from the King's Oak," he said, looking at my face. "Nothing to speak of," I said, looking straight into his brown eyes. "I read you," he said. The line at the shaded buffet table was beginning to queue up, and a large crowd of handsome people was milling about. Charlie called from a big table at the far end of the veranda, and Tish and I went to join him. Pat Dabney slouched opposite Carter, smoking and drinking bourbon. On a left were two men I did not know. "Hello, Pat," I said. "Miss Calhoun," she drawled, lifting her bourbon glass. "Heard you had an unproductive morning out at the King's Oak," she said. "You must smell powerfully like the city." "I guess I do at that," I said. "Are you a hunter as well as a rider?" "Pat is a better hunter than almost any man in a 1,000-mile radius," one of the unfamiliar men said. He was small and going fat and had a soft, unformed baby's mouth, curved up in a sweet smile. "I'm Chip Dabney," he said. "Dad told me he was taking the pretty new school mom down to King's Oak this morning. I'd hoped we'd give you a better show than apparently you had." "Maybe next time," I said. "Next time I'll take you myself and we'll do a whole lot better," he said, still smiling. "I've got the next dance, Chip," Carter said, his good voice level. "Okay, good buddy," Chip Dabney said. "No sweat. Miss Andy, this is Francis Milliken. He's the top operating man at the Big Silver." He was tall and thin, almost to gauntness. "Nobody took one today," Chip Dabney said. "Frank, are you sure you guys aren't feeding them strontium 90 over there?" Everyone turned to look at Francis Milliken. The flat eyes did not change. "Our runoff and groundwater are cleaner than any facility in the network," he said. "If you tested the Big Silver right now, you'd find it clean enough to bathe a baby in." "How are the boys, Pat?" Tish said quickly, and Pat Dabney turned to smile at her. "Fine. They should be going straight on to school, but their fathers promised them a week out of that goddamn shack on the creek." "Speaking of Tom, is he here today?" Charlie said. "He's usually here for the first hunt." "And I'm usually not, so you probably won't be seeing him," Pat Dabney said. Her eyes were hooded and heavy with alcohol. "He's scared I'll tell on him. Tell what he does back there in the woods. Tell what he thinks is back there." "If he says it's back there, it is, whatever it is," Charlie said. "He goes too far," she said. "He just can't leave it alone. He loves that fucking swamp more than anything." "Think of the devil," Tish said. We all turned our heads to follow her eyes. He was there, the man of my morning. He was grinning in response to something someone on the edge of the crowd had said to him. But despite the grin, it was a wild face. I was not in the least surprised that this was the fabled Tom Dabney. He was surrounded almost before the truck door closed. Men went up to him and clapped his shoulders. Women preened and bridled before him. I wanted to jump up and run. Instead, I picked up Tish's half-finished drink and drained it. Charlie went out and returned with him. "I want you to meet our resident crazy," he said. "Andy, this is Tom Dabney, the wild man of Goat Creek. Tom, this is Andy Calhoun. She's your new little schoolmate, so don't try to rape her for a week or two." "Mrs. Calhoun and I have already met," Tom Dabney said. "I scared her to death with a dead deer." My head came up and I could feel heat flooding my face. I could also feel Pat Dabney's eyes on me like coals. "I ran into her in the parking lot at school the other night with a deer on my hood," he said. Tom Dabney grinned again. "I think I'll call you Andrea. You don't look like an Andy." Rage stilled the struggling of my breath in an instant. "It isn't Andrea, it's Diana," I said coldly. "And no matter whether you like it or not, it's Andy or nothing." He was silent for so long that I thought I had offended him. And then he laughed, a great joyous whoop. "Ah, God," he said, "is it really Diana? Are you kidding me?" "I wouldn't for the world," I said. "Does Diana bother you?" "No," he said, still laughing. "Diana's great. It's perfect." "You're perfect. In fact, I guess I'm going to have to marry you." Still laughing, he walked away into the crowd. "Take care of yourself, Diana," he called. I knew then. He knows I saw him naked in the woods, covered with blood and kissing a dead deer, I thought. "Well," Pat Dabney said, "I know what Tom will be doing with himself this year. Providing, of course, that Andy is partial to poison ivy and deer ticks on a butt. You could do worse, Andy. He's crazy as a loon, of course, but he's the best fuck I've ever had, and I've had a lot." "I'll just bet you have, Pat," I said. "I have to pee," Pat Dabney said, and rose from the table and lurched away. On the way home in the Jaguar, I sat in silence, aching with fatigue. Carter took my hand. "Pemberton old mass can get a little much sometimes," he said. "Tell you what, let's get Hillary and go home and take huge naps, and then I'll come over and bring the biggest pizza I can find. How does that sound?" I squeezed his hand gratefully. "Nothing on earth ever sounded better," I said. In the weeks before the Widder people returned with their servants and horses, Pemberton hummed with energy and purpose. Back in the woods where our little house stood, mornings and evenings were cool and blue with autumn. And once on a night of mist and rain, I lit the logs that Carter had laid in our fireplace, and Hillary and I had our supper before it. It was a magical night, and envisioning fall and winter nights ahead of us in the leaping firelight, I was very nearly happy. It was, I thought, a good thing after all that we had come to Pemberton. I said as much to Tish in mid-month when she and I took Hillary to French Creek Mall on the other side of town to look for school shoes. When Hillary asked to stop at McDonald's, we sat in the air-conditioned blazer and ate our French fries and drank our Diet Cokes. When Hillary went to the restroom, I told Tish I thought Hillary and I could make it work here. "Well, I should hope so," she said. "But I think you're going to have to do it on Pemberton's terms and not yours," she said. "What do you mean?" I said. "I thought making it on my own terms was the whole point of this great new adventure in living." "You won't give an inch to the town," she said. "You live right in the very epicenter of old Pemberton, and you still act like you're hookworm poor. You don't wear your pretty clothes, and you put Hillary in public school and let her ride the bus when Pemberton Day is not 3 blocks away from your front door, and you won't let her take riding lessons. You're never going to be a part of Pemberton, and neither is Hillary. You know I can't afford Pemberton Day. You know what I make? We may not be hookworm poor, but we sure as hell are white-collar poor, and I'm not going to pretend we're not just because everybody around me is rich. I don't want a pretentious life for either of us." "Oh, shit," Tish snapped. "I know good and goddamned well Chris pays you enough child support to put Hillary in Pemberton Day and give her lessons in every sport there is, even if he hasn't called or written." "Hillary hasn't complained," I said sullenly. She hasn't said a word about much of anything since you got here, Tish said. She hasn't got one single friend her own age. When she isn't in school, she's with you or me. What you're doing for her isn't protecting her. It's sucking the life and independence out of her. Pretty soon, you're going to have made her afraid of literally everything. Is that what you want for Hillary? Bright, scalding anger flooded me. Under it, fear hissed like a snake. Could she be right? Could Hillary be truly ill, and had I, out of fear, been unwilling to see it? By the time I could gather my wits, Hillary was coming out of the restaurant, and I looked closely at her. Her once luminous blue eyes were dull, and she averted them from everyone she passed. She drew herself sharply away from anyone who came within range of touching her, and she sought my face with her eyes. She breathed through her mouth in her intensity to reach the car and me, and for a terrible moment, I saw what Tish saw. Hillary looked almost retarded. "Oh, dear God," I whispered. "I've made her sick." "No, you haven't," Tish said, squeezing my hand. "Just a little too dependent on you. Try the riding lessons. Carter will teach you if you don't want Pat. He's wonderful with kids." And so it was that Hillary began riding lessons with Pat Dabney herself. She was still far too quiet, but the glimmer of life in her eyes made my heart jolt with hope and gratitude to Tish. "That's twice in a year you've saved us, Tish." "I haven't saved her," Tish said. "She's still got a long way to go. Carter would have if I hadn't. He was all set to talk to you." "Were you?" I asked Carter a couple of nights later, when we sat in front of my fireplace with a bottle of good Cabernet Sauvignon. "Yes," he said, "I was. And with my heart in my throat, I was scared to death you'd tell me to take a hike. That's something I don't think I could handle, Andy Panda." He reached out and traced the line of my mouth with his finger. "Carter, don't," I whispered. "I scared you, didn't I?" he said. "I'm sorry, Andy. Don't worry. I'm not going to put the move on you. Not until you give me the green light. I know what you've just been through, both of you. Tish told me. I'd like to offer you the moon, but I can at least offer you safety. Let me be your good guy, comfortable old shoe." "I can't imagine what's in that for you," I said. He laughed and reached over and rumpled my hair. "I can sense in you a kind of aptitude for commitment. It's a powerful thing, an absolute. I want to be around when you put it to use. I'd like to think it might be me you commit to." He sensed it then. The dark thing, the power. But he had misread it. "Thank you," I said. "I wish there was more I could give you, and I hope there will be. I'll work on it. Meanwhile, thank you." "Work on it, Andy," he said. "So how is it going with you and Carter?" Tish said a day or so later. "It's puzzling, Tish. He couldn't have been sitting around in a cell for 5 years, and yet there he was, ready and available." Tish grinned. "He's just, shall we say, terminated a 2-year go-round with Pat Dabney. Said he felt too much like a prize stud. It was all she ever wanted to do. And she drinks too much. She's been going through men like a sailor on shore leave ever since she divorced Tom, and that's been 7 or 8 years. Charlie thinks she still has a thing for Tom." "What happened with them?" I said. "Was she too much for him, too?" "I hardly think so. Tom Dabney screws as much as Pat does when he can. He's just nicer about it. When they first married, they were a real pair, both of them so alive and good-looking and vital. But then the children came along, and he wouldn't leave that old place on Goat Creek, and he wouldn't stop going off in the Big Silver for days and sometimes weeks at a time with Scratch Purvis, that old black man he hangs around with. And there were other things. She hints about things that he does or did. Anyway, her daddy built them a big house, and when Tom wouldn't move with her, she left him and took the children. She's forever on his case, and he doesn't see much of his children at all." "And he hasn't remarried?" I said, as carelessly as I could. "I don't imagine he'll marry again. I don't know a woman who'd be willing to spend her life out in that wilderness. If he weren't such a darling, he'd be impossible." "I don't find him the least bit darling," I said. "I could have sworn you found him interesting at any rate," she said. "I haven't seen hide in the hair of him," I said. "I can't imagine where he'd hide." "Oh, I bet I know," Tish said. "I forgot. He takes off a couple of weeks every fall and spring and goes way back in the Big Silver and camps and hunts. He and Scratch Purvis, the old black man I told you about, and Martin Longstreet. He's one of your deans, Andy, and Reese Carmody. Reese is an attorney. He's about Charlie and Carter's age, but he hasn't practiced much in years. Mainly drinks. Anyway, the four of them hunt and fish together a lot. God knows what they do up in there. On Friday afternoon in mid-October, the nurse at Hillary's school called me and said that Hillary had been violently sick in the restroom and then locked herself into the stall. She was, the nurse said, crying hysterically. There was no one in the restroom but Hillary's teacher and the school nurse when I arrived. At first, I could not get her to open the stall. None of the teachers or the nurse could say what had set her off. I said as firmly as I could, "Hillary, if you don't open that door and come out right now, the riding lessons are over. I'm going to count to 10. You can come out or not, it's up to you. But when I get to 10, if you're not out of there, you can kiss the horse goodbye." Silence. At 8, I heard her slip the bolt back in the lock, and on 9, she was outside. My heart stopped. She looked ghastly. Her face was mottled and swollen with tears, and her red eyes were deeply circled with shadows. Her hair was pasted to her head. She could not breathe through her congested nose. "What happened to you, baby? Are you sick?" I said, putting my palm to her forehead. It was clammy and cold. "I want to go home," Hillary whispered. "I want to go home." "We're going home," I said. "Just let me wash your face and hands here." "No!" It was a shriek of pure horror. "No water," she screamed. "No water." "All right, no water," I said, my voice shaking. She let me lead her out of the building and settle her into the car, but she would not speak again. It was only when I had her upstairs in her bedroom that she broke her silence. They said there was something in the water that came from the bomb plant," she whispered, turning her face away from me. "They said it got into your blood and dried it up and rotted your bones, and you died in awful pain. They said it made the water catch on fire and smoke, and it used to be just over there where the black people live, way up in the woods near where the bomb plant is. But now it's coming under the ground over to where we are. They said I already had it in me. We had a movie in geography this morning, and when they turned the lights off, they said I lit up like a neon sun, and they said they could see my bones shining through my skin. They said the bomb plant knows about it, and they lie about it, and then they threw water all over me." She was crying again. I hugged her to me. "Hillary, baby, that's all wrong," I said. "You don't think the government would hurt its own people, do you? They were teasing you, sugar." "They said you'd say that," Hillary said. Her voice was lifeless. Her eyes were dead. "They said some of the kids had seen the water burning and smoking, and all of them had died right after. They said their bones shone through their skin like mine did." "Who, Hillary? Who?" I held her fiercely against me. "The black children. The ones that come on the bus from out by the bomb plant. They know about the water because they've seen it. Mama, it comes under the ground." "Hillary," I said, "do you think I would bring you to a place that wasn't safe?" "No, ma'am," she mumbled. Her eyes slid away, and she fidgeted under my touch. She finally let me put her into the bath, but she scrambled right out and then climbed into her bed. The next day, Saturday, she did not want to go and ride. She was very quiet and very pale, and she slept a lot. I told Carter about it that night. "God," he said, "I don't blame her for locking herself in the john. I don't know what the business about the water shining is, but I know the runoff water from the reactors steams sometimes. But it's just hot. I mean, in the ordinary sense of the word. That water's tested 6 ways to Sunday every day of the week by plant people and the EPA and the Department of Energy, not to mention every environmental group under the sun. They can get all the records from the plant, and they do. The Big Silver is noted for its openness. Anybody can have a plant tour. We really ought to take Hillary on one." "It's not a bad idea," I said, somehow hating it. "But it's not just this business. Somehow Hillary just isn't thriving here. The only time she shows any of her old life and animation is when she's over at Pat's on a horse. She's got to heal in every area. I don't know. Pemberton seemed so perfect at first. I thought there could be nothing in a place like this to harm her. Something's still wrong, and I can't put my finger on it." There's no place without harm, Andy, he said softly. Give her time. If I were you, I'd take her out of that school and put her in Pemberton Day. I know you don't want to make a little elitist out of her, but she hasn't got much in common with kids who believe in burning water and rotting blood. She belongs in a world of books and music and cultivation. I didn't reply, and he said, You have every right in the world to tell me to mind my own business. I hope we are your business, Hillary and I said slowly. I'll think about it, and meanwhile I'll see if she wouldn't like to take a tour of the plant. Say when, he said. Hillary was adamant about not going into the big silver plant, so I settled for taking her on an expedition out U.S. Highway 35 the next day, Sunday, as far as the plant gate. A uniformed guard sat at rest in the gatehouse. The guard looked at us incuriously. Carter put his head out the window and said, Just looking. We wanted to show the little girl the gate. Glad to have you, the guard said. And Carter turned the Jaguar around in the turnaround area, and we headed back out 35. Was that man a secret agent? Hillary asked. Nope, Carter said. Did he have a gun? Hillary said. I didn't see one, but I sort of doubt it. I think they rely mostly on electronics and dogs. Killer dogs? Hillary breathed. Tracking dogs and good barkers, more likely, Carter said patiently. I don't imagine there's any more security here than you'd get at a big private plant where they make expensive things. In essence, that's just what it is, a business. You aren't still scared of it, are you? I said. You can see that it's just a place where people come to work. Yeah, she said. In that case, what do you say to lunch? Carter said. Okay, Hillary said, smiling at him. And then can I go over to the stable? I don't see why not, I said, stretching in relief. And then we can go to the movies. Don't push it, I said. You missed an afternoon of school Friday. You need to find out if there was any homework and make it up. I don't care if there was, Hillary said. I hate that stupid school. I want to go to Pemberton Day. Pat says there's nobody at my school but me and the niggers. She says, I don't care what she says, I rounded on her. I don't ever want to hear you say that word again. And I'm going to have to think twice about letting you ride it, runaway, if that's the sort of thing Mrs. Dabney is saying to you. Look, I'll go talk to Pat, Carter said. She doesn't mean half she says, and she wouldn't want to upset you or influence Hillary. Hold off till we have, okay? Okay, I said, but I said it grudgingly. If the riding lessons had not been such a liberation for Hillary, I would have stopped them then and there. The great rain that hung in the west on that Sunday did indeed bring autumn with it. For me, that first slow, misted bronze and yellow autumn of the wiregrass and swamp forests was inexpressibly beautiful. The light that poured down into the woods and fields and town was like syrup, like smoke. My heart and senses seemed to deepen and expand. Old Pemberton burst into its autumn social watercourse like a river in spate, and I relaxed the fierce knot of resistance inside and let Tish and Carter lead me into its shallows. Carter did indeed have the small dinner party for me with four other couples whom I liked. They were old Pembertonians like he was. After that, as if I had been tacitly stamped approved, I did fairly well in Pemberton society, I suppose. I knew instinctively that I was welcome as Tish and Charlie Coulter's nice old friend, Carter Devereaux's date this season. Reluctantly, I capitulated and told Hillary she could start Pemberton Day School at the beginning of the winter quarter. After that, she was almost herself again. She avoided water when she could, but it seemed a manageable neurosis. I had given up the idea, finally, of having Hillary perfectly healed. We would measure progress in degrees. And then, in early November, Pat Dabney had her over to her house with her young exercise riders, and Hillary came face to face with a truly terrible thing in Pat's library. A sort of shawl made entirely of the stitched-together, mangled masks of foxes taken in hunts. Some of them were still dark with blood, and they all grinned in hideous recti of agony and fear. Hillary had gone white and nearly fainted, and had to cry. Pat snapped at her, casually and brutally, in front of all Hillary's cool-eyed young heroes. For God's sake, Hillary, call your mother. This house is no place for crybabies. I got the story out of her only after an afternoon of hysterics. She was mortally ashamed. She ran a high fever for several days. Pinched white silences began again. Carter stopped me from going over to Pat Dabney's house and confronting her. No, let it be, he said. It's Hillary's affair, not yours. Pat's world is tough, Andy. If Hillary wants to live in it, she'll have to accept the terms. And so Hillary did not go back to Pat Dabney's stable. I did not interfere. Just before Thanksgiving, Carter asked Hillary and me to an afternoon party at Tom Dabney's house out on Goat Creek. He specifically asked me to bring you and Hillary. He'd heard Pat had done a number on her, and he thought Goat Creek could fix up again. Tell Diana to please give Goat Creek just one day. I've seen it heal terrible wounds, is what he said. Diana, huh? It's but one of his many affectations, I said. Did he really say that about healing? Did he use that word? He did. He'll won't be the only child, and if nothing else, she might like to see the goats and the other animals. He has quite a menagerie out there. And so we came to Goat Creek for the first time. Hillary had agreed to come only on the condition that I not go off and leave her with anybody she did not know. We passed the entrance to King's Oak, and about 2 miles further on we were in woods as dense and silent and seemingly primal as those we had driven through to reach King's Oak. I said as much to Carter. It's part of the same land, he said. Tom kept just a strip between Clay's land and the half of King's Oak that belongs to the big silver plant now.
Are we going to where the bomb plant is? Hillary breathed.
No, sugar, Carter said. We're going to be right on Goat Creek, and that runs parallel to the river. It's on the other side that the plant property starts.
A creek and a river? She began in a tight, high sing-song that meant one of the terrors was not too far off.
Hillary, you do not have to go anywhere near the water, I said as firmly as I could. You don't even have to drink it. But I hope you won't feel you have to point it out to Mr. Dabney. We lurched out of the forest and into a large, sunlit clearing, and there was Tom Dabney's little house, sprawling atop a small rise on the creek bank. The house was small, but it was so low and flung out along the brow of the rise and down its slope that it seemed much larger. It glowed in the sun like a pomegranate, like a plum. It was completely surrounded by a deep-roofed porch. Down beyond the house I could see a fringe of small willows and stands of reeds and aquatic plants the color of a lion's coat. Beyond them the wide creek ran slowly, slowly. Where is everybody? I asked. Probably around back on the porch overlooking the creek, Carter said. Tom usually sets up there for parties. I can smell the barbecue pit from here. Tom Dabney came around the side of the house. Wonderfully, magically, on his shoulder sat a large raccoon, black button eyes gleaming out of his bandit mask. Hillary smiled, a tentative, wondering smile.
The glamorous Calhoun women, Tom Dabney said. I'm awfully glad you came to my Thanksgiving party.
He kissed my cheek and picked up Hillary's hand and kissed it. Tom held her hand in his arm straight, and turned his head and murmured something to the raccoon. It waddled down his arm and onto Hillary's shoulder and nestled itself in her hair. She turned her head so that her cheek lay against the raccoon's dense brindle fur. Is it okay? I said to Tom.
Oh, sure, he said. Earl doesn't know he's a raccoon, but is very particular about who he bums rides with. You should be flattered, Hillary.
We moved around to the back of the house, where a group of about 30 people stood and sat round on a vast, weathered porch. It must have sat on pilings, for the dark water flowed directly beneath it. He took us among his guests and introduced us, Hillary still bearing Earl on her shoulder like a talisman. Off at the water's edge, on a small point screened by willows, children laughed and shouted, accompanied by the happy woof of big dogs and the quonk of May ducks. "Would you like to see the rest of the house?" Tom Dabney said. "Yes," I said, "I really would." We tripped behind him through a screen door off the deck, and were in a great low-ceilinged room beamed with rough, undressed cypress logs and walled only in screening. An enormous central fireplace of stone dominated it, and bookshelves. On the fireplace was the head of a magnificent 12-point buck. Two or three guitars lay about the room. He led us around the freestanding fireplace, and I saw that the other side of it lay in what must be his bedroom or sleeping area. He had positioned his bed so that when he lay in it, all he could see was the dark water and the trees of the big silver forest. On the stone chimney hung an array of hunting weapons.
for it was the bed that dominated the room. It was enormous, and it was completely shrouded in a canopy of gauzy fabric. On it lay a huge throw of very superior mink. I blushed scarlet and turned away from the bed. He grinned, not missing my discomfort. "A Sybarite's bed, obviously," he said. "It ought to be in Hugh Hefner's bedroom. But I came by it honestly. It was made in England for my great-grandfather." "What do you do in winter?" I asked hastily. "I have canvas awning things all around, and I stay in bed a lot. Or I stay in the hot tub till my skin begins to slough off."
"Hot tub," I said. "Of course."
Carter called us from the porch then, and by the time we got back outside, Clay Dabney was there with a pretty white-haired woman whom Tom introduced to us as his Aunt Daisy.
"Sorry we're late," Clay said to his nephew. "Chip has got him a live one in town, looking the place over with an eye to bring in a group in to do some hunting. Chip wanted me to take him around King's Oak because he was interested in the history of the place, and Chip doesn't know crap about that."
"Well, I hope you land him," Tom said. We all filed past the laden buffet table and filled our plates, Hillary keeping close to Carter and me, but looking at Tom out of the corner of her eyes. We ate until we could eat no more. I looked over at Hillary, who was busily munching, surreptitiously tossing scraps to Earl, who had stationed himself under her chair. When we finished, the shadows were growing long and blue, and the air was cooling fast. The children, rested with the grown-up talk and the music, dashed back down to the creek edge to play, calling to Hillary to come, but she shrank back. "Come on in the living room, Hill," Tish said. "I hear Tom's silly ducks in there. You ought to meet him." Hillary got up and put a hand in Tish's, and they disappeared into the house. Tom Dabney looked over at me. "Something frightened her," he said.
"What was it?"
"Some of the children in a class at school told her an awful thing about the creek water lighting up and burning and turning her blood black and rotting her bones," I said. "She's been absolutely terrified of water ever since." Tom looked at me for a moment, then over at Scratch Purvis.
"I've seed that," Scratch said. "I've seed the creek light up. It ain't no tall tale."
"Yeah, and you know it's swamp gas," Tom said. "It doesn't mean anything except that somewhere down in the mud something's rotting that's producing methane." We were still on the porch as the afternoon grayed out. And then, as suddenly as if someone had thrown a switch, the world went crimson and magenta and gold, and the sky over the creek flamed into unearthly beauty. Great streamers of gold and red and pink and purple spread across the sky, and above it, in the last unearthly blue of the day, the white ghost of a full moon rose. No one spoke. I scarcely breathed. As suddenly as it had come, the sunset flared out and it was night. The low moon swelled into translucent whiteness. Goat Creek burned with cold radiance. The water and the air and the fringing reeds were pure silver, alive and flaming. Hillary made a little sound. Was this what the children had meant? Tom looked at her and picked up the Martin and began to play and sing softly. He sang an old 1960s song. "Moon River, wider than a mile, I'm crossing you in style someday. Dream maker, you heartbreaker, wherever you're going, I'm going your way." Hillary looked at him and at the moon-burning creek. She smiled very slightly, and he smiled back.
"How about it, Hillary Calhoun?" he said. "Our song." Her smile widened, too.
"Hillary," he said, "you don't ever have to be afraid here. Goat Creek is a special place. It makes you well. It doesn't hurt you." Slowly he got to his feet, still with his hands on her shoulders, and just as slowly she rose, and together they walked down the wooden steps onto the burning silver grass and across the yard. At the edge of the creek, Tom Dabney leaned down and whispered something to Hillary. And she nodded, and they both bent and took off their shoes and socks and rolled up the cuffs of their pants. Tom Dabney threw back his head and began to sing, and then he began to dance. In the pouring moonlight, like something out of antiquity, like a lissome god of night and wild places, he sang and danced on the banks of Goat Creek. Hillary joined him. He took her hands and whirled her around, and they sang and sang. The dark, silver-stained man and my silver-dipped child. When they finished the song, they ran without pause straight into the shallow water of Goat Creek and cavorted in the flying silver, stooping now and then to splash great handfuls of water on each other, drowned and dripping and haloed in silver. Carter could not move, and he did not speak. And afterwards I never could say how long I sat on that moon-burnt porch, with tears running down my face, watching my daughter dance and sing in the moonlight in the silver water of Goat Creek. "So what do you think now?" Tish said, pouring herself a second margarita from the pitcher Charlie had left on the sideboard. It was the Sunday after Thanksgiving, and Carter and I had gone over to their house. Hillary had gone almost reluctantly out to Pat Dabney's stable. "It was okay," I said. "It was nice." Carter stared at me. He did not say anything. I knew I was going to have to talk to him about that night. It was too potent to leave to silence. I asked him in for coffee when we got home, and he came and settled into the place on the sofa that had become his. "Andy, I think I lost you a week ago out at Goat Creek. I think I know just when it happened." "No," I said. "Something did happen, but it wasn't just your losing me. It wasn't me it happened to." "But you're going out there again, aren't you?" he said. "Yes," I said, "of course I am. Of course we are. You saw her, Carter." "I know," he said. His wonderful voice was low and washed in hurt. I slid across the sofa and pressed myself against him. "I won't go away from you," I said fiercely. "I want to get closer. Carter, please make love to me." And he did. The good big man who had been my rock and my anchor for 3 careening months became also my lover. He was slow and gentle. His hands seemed to value me, and his hardness slipping into me was slow and careful, so that his very manhood seemed to cherish me. I relaxed and rode with him, rocking in a dreamlike fugue of sweetness and tenderness. After what seemed a very long time, I felt him quicken and swell, heard the soft words become urgent. I quickened my own hips, waiting for the helpless chain explosion. I waited for my own atonal wail of abandonment and loss. None came. I heard his cry and felt his climax, but I felt only the lightning of his weight upon me. It was over, and I had not lost myself. I felt a surge of relief that was near joy. Nothing would be asked of me with this man then. I would not have to pay for his love. "I love you, Andy," he said. "I don't want to hear 'I love you' from you right now. You wouldn't mean it. But I would like to know that you care for me." "I do care," I said gratefully. That was wonderful for me. You'll have to take my word that it was. But far down within me, as faint and far away as a ghost of an echo on a thunderous night, something cried out. Some emptiness wailed. "Fill me." From that instant, I strove with all my being to become more completely a citizen of Carter's Pemberton world. I went out of my way to avoid Tom at school. But the pull of Goat Creek was too deep and tidal in Hillary to keep her away. She had, after all, been reborn there. She nagged me until I found her recording of Henry Mancini's Moon River, and she played it for hours, day in and day out. "You're going to make me sick of that song," I said. "Aren't you just the slightest bit weary of it by now?" "No," she said, "it's my song, mine and Tom's. I'll never get tired of it. He's the dream maker. You know, in Moon River, that's Tom, the dream maker." But I did not give in until Tom passed us in his truck on the sidewalk outside the movie theater and shouted, "Hey, Hillary, there's a little brown goat waiting for you out at the creek." Then the brief hiatus of normalcy was over, and I knew it. I sought him out between classes the next day and said, almost formally, "When would be a good time for us to come out?" And he said, "How about after school today?" And I said, "Thank you very much. We'll see you then." And knew as I closed the door on my side of the Toyota outside Hillary's school that afternoon that I was driving towards something as huge in our lives as a birth or a death. He was nowhere in evidence when I parked the car in front of the house, but the truck was there. He may be off in the woods somewhere, Hill, I said. But just then his voice called to us. Come on in. We found him inside in front of the fire, kneeling before a very small goat. It had a white-striped face of great sweetness and charm. Is it mine? Hillary said on a little wind of disbelief and joy. All 19 pounds of her, Tom Dabney said. I'd been telling her she was a princess. Her daddy was a veritable king among goats. I've been calling her Artemis, after another princess who lived in the woods. I'm going to call her Missy, she said, for Artemis. Where is her daddy? He's dead, Tom Dabney said. It was just his time to die. Was he old? No. But he was ready. I knew then that he had, in some way and for some reason, killed the goat himself. Hillary did not say anything else, and turned her attention to the little goat in her arms. I won't have her upset, Tom, I said. She's still too fragile to handle death and dying. You can't stop her from being upset, Diana. You can only try to make sure the wrong things don't upset her. A natural death shouldn't be one of them. Was it natural? I turned to look at him. It was, he said matter-of-factly. For him, it was entirely natural. Stay for supper, Tom said. There's something I want to show you after the moon rises. I won't keep you late. We were quiet as we ate, and by the time he had made espresso on a belching old machine and brought it to me in front of the fire, it was full dark, and the creek and woods outside were beginning to whiten with the light of the rising moon. Ready to march, he said. I really want you to see this. It only happens in the fall and after dark, and maybe once or twice in any lifetime. If Hillary is too sleepy to walk, I'll carry her. I want to go with you, Hillary said. I can walk by myself. Tom took a short, hooked knife and thrust it into his belt. I raised my eyebrows and he said, For undergrowth. By the way, I said, where is it we're going? To the river, he said. I thought it was time you two met the Big Silver. Moving more quietly than I could have imagined in the soft moccasins he had changed into, he walked out of the clearing. I looked back for Hillary, and when I turned my head again, he had vanished. I stared stupidly at the line of trees. There was a slight movement, and he was there again. How did you do that? Hillary asked. I've watched deer do it all my life, he said. It's a matter of moving very slowly, almost in slow motion, and sort of sinking your feet into the next step. Focus your mind on the woods and the trees and the ground, and try to feel like a part of them, and somehow you do become a part of them. Most good trackers can do it. We crossed the creek on a sturdy log footbridge and moved east. Out of the clearing, the huge hardwoods closed over our heads in a canopy, but enough light dappled the spongy ground so that following Tom Dabney's silent feet, we could walk with relative ease. Beside me, her hand in mine, Hillary trudged determinedly. Ahead of us, Tom talked softly. The Big Silver Swamp runs half the length of the state. There were 24 million acres of it once. Now there are less than 5 million left. But what's left is some of the oldest woodland in the world. Some of the plants and animals are living fossils. You can't find any wilder woods anywhere in the world than these around the Big Silver. We walked in silence for a while. As we drew near the river, the great arching hardwoods gave way gradually to the phantasmagorical monolithic shapes of the huge water tupelos and bald cypresses. The darkness was almost palpable here, dense and impenetrable. Only stray shafts of silver radiance cut down into the still, thick, black water in which the trees stood. We were walking along a small ridge that rose a scant foot above the water, and I felt a cold revulsion looking down into it. It looked secret and primeval and somehow sly, as if it were a living element, possessed of some ancient and unspeakable knowledge, some vast and awful secret it kept from men. Is it much further, Hillary said. Her voice and steps were flagging. We're there now, Tom Dabney said. The place I'm taking you to see is underwater all the time except after a very dry summer and fall like we've had this year. His voice was nearly a whisper, but it rang in the thick silence like the cry of a nightbird. Cold fear began to uncoil in my chest, and I felt cold sweat start at my hairline. I wanted to turn and run wildly for light and air and safety. "We're almost there," he said. "It's just beyond that canebrake." He stepped up to that wall of cane and, as before at the edge of the forest, simply vanished into it. "Okay, open up," I called. The cane parted, and we preceded him through and stopped. Below us lay the bed of what appeared to be a large, shallow, empty lake. I thought it must be about 15 feet deep, and the size of a couple of football fields held end to end. Black water giving back the white moon covered its bottom, but it was the trees that stopped the eye and heart. They marched along the lake bottom in ranks, as if planted by some titan's hand eons ago. Great, black, moss-bearded cypresses, and tupelos as tall as the hardwoods we had passed under earlier, 100 feet and more. And their huge, black, steeple-like knees, like the flying buttresses of a medieval cathedral, soared 10 and 12 feet into the air over the shallow black water. They would have dwarfed a man. They looked in the cold white radiance, like some monstrous Stonehenge, like prehistoric monuments to an unimaginable god. There was nothing there in all that lunar whiteness and soulless ebony that could or would speak to the heart of a man. The place seemed inimical to life. Tom motioned for us to all sit down. "You'll never see those knees until we've had a dry enough spell for the water to recede," he said. "Sit still now and watch. The show isn't over yet." It was almost half an hour later when the deer came. A band of perhaps 80 deer, forming themselves out of the darkness as Tom Dabney had, on the far lip of the slough, ghosting down its steep sides and onto its floor in loose double lines, as if they were being sung by unheard pipes. When the last one, the great many-branched buck, had disappeared, Hillary said simply, "It makes me cry." "What is it?" I said, forming normalcy into my voice. "Why do they go like that in lines?"
"I don't know what it is," he said. "I've seen it the 3 times I've seen the slough dry, but I've never seen it anywhere else. Usually deer travel in small bands, a buck with a few does and fawns, but it's never more than 5 or 6 to a buck. Maybe this one is a master animal."
"What's that?" Hillary said. In most of the hunting mythologies, men believed in a master animal. "Kind of the guiding spirit of the animals they hunted," he said. "A master animal had great powers, and a soul like a man. And so when it was necessary to hunt and kill, the hunters would do elaborate rituals, and after they had killed their quarry, they would do others to propitiate the soul, the spirit of the master animal, so they wouldn't be punished for it."
"Like putting an oak leaf into a dead deer's mouth?" I did not say. "Like painting yourself with its blood?" "You really must be into myths," I said. "Sometimes I think myths are the only real truths we have," he said. "I think myths are the way we get in touch with the real experience of being alive. We've killed off most of our myths, and you can see the results in every ghetto and drug ward and every poison stream on this planet.
Without myths, we have nothing to honor. Mythic thinking is a way of seeing everything as a thou.
Without it, all of life becomes just an it. You might think twice about dishonoring a thou, but who cares about an it?"
I felt the sense and truth of what he said.
I hoped Hillary was listening. It was the kind of thing I wanted her to grow up knowing. But I saw that her lashes were feathered on her cheeks and knew that she had fallen asleep. "You really do love all this, don't you?" I said. "I really do," he said. "The woods are the greatest thous there are. The animals are. I guess the woods are everything to me. I don't mean that there's nothing else in my life," he said. "I have a life full of things I love and want. I just mean that this is where everything comes from. The wild is the highest and purest order we have. When we lose it, we've lost the heart and core of us."
"People say that about God," I said.
"People worship that." He smiled again.
"Do you think I'm crazy?"
"No," I said. "Just single-minded.
I think that scares me worse than crazy.
Don't be afraid of me, he said softly. I would never hurt you. I might, or rather what I know, might even heal you.
You keep talking about healing.
Do you think I need healing?
Why else would you come here, he said simply.
Why else would you bring your daughter back here?
We've really got to go, I said. It must be after midnight.
He bent and sprung Hillary to his shoulder.
Holding her easily, he led the way back into the canebrake. By the time we fetched up at the house, the moon had sailed small and high into the sky.
Does the plant being out there bother you, I said, as he was putting Hillary into the Toyota?
The big silver?
No, he said. It's not my problem.
My job is to tend to all of this, to look out for the woods, for the animals.
But you kill, I said. You hunt yourself.
One day I'll tell you about that, he said. I'd like you to know about the killing.
I could never do it, I said.
That's okay. It's enough for you to know about the woods.
I'll show you. I'll teach you.
We can start whenever you like. Just let me know.
The week before Christmas, my school and Hillary's closed for the long holiday, and the season in Pemberton moved into high gear. I went to coffees, brunches, teas, cotillions, balls. I pulled out the plastic-shrouded formal clothes that had been my winter evening uniforms in the days of Chris and Buckhead and wore them. Carter beside me in perfect conservative evening clothes smiled proudly. On the 21st of December, Pat Dabney had an annual eggnog party, and I went with Carter, wearing the short white silk jersey dinner dress that was cut in a deep V front and back and clasped under my breasts with an ivory and gold knot, Grecian style. I'd bought a gold and white fillet of artificial leaves for my hair like a laurel and wore it. Pagan fairly rang in the air around me. Everyone I had ever met in Pemberton, and many I had not, were there in Pat's exquisite drawing and dining room. Pat Dabney came up to us, looking so utterly spectacular that I felt my silk turn to polyester on my body and my hair tangle itself into a mass of spitting snakes.
"Pat, you look absolutely gorgeous," I said spontaneously.
"Thank you, sweetie," she said in a rich voice. "You look mightily fetching, too, all dressed up in your native costume. When is the sacrifice?"
I caught my breath, and Carter inhaled deeply.
Pat laughed and hugged me lightly.
"Just a joke, darling, and a bad one," she said. "Simmer down, Carter. Forgive me, both of you. You look pretty as a picture, Andy."
She took me by the hand and led me through the crowd to the punch bowl. From the back of the group, an exuberant tenor sang, "Don't change a hair for me, not if you care for me." And Tom Dabney, in evening dress, came waltzing out of the crowd and caught me in his arms and swung me around in a whirling, perfect waltz. He swooped me down the length of Pat's polished floor to where a scarlet-tied kissing ball hung in an archway, and in front of virtually everyone, he bent me over his arm like Rhett Butler and kissed me until I lost my breath and stumbled backwards, and only his arms prevented me from falling on my rear. It was a hard kiss, and a long one, but I remember thinking how soft his mouth was, and somehow cherishing. I only dimly heard the cheers and claps from the other guests. I saw Carter with Pat Dabney at his side. Both of them, I could plainly see, were furiously angry, and an answering anger leaped along my veins. Their anger spoke of ownership. How dare they?
"Please, sir, may I have some more?"
I piped in as good a British child's voice as I could manage. The crowd exploded in laughter and applause. Tom bowed exultantly and kissed me again. After that, he moved off into the crowd, and I went back to Carter's side, and the ice went out of his eyes, but he did not speak directly to me. Near the end of the evening, as people were beginning to drift toward the front door, Tom came up to say goodnight to Pat. Carter and I stood in the group.
"Thanks, Pat. It was a terrific party, as always," Tom said pleasantly to his ex-wife.
"Tell the boys I'll be by about noon tomorrow to pick them up. Christmas shopping spree."
"You better dig deep, sweetie," Pat drawled. "I've already told them what they're getting from you.
You did say anything within reason."
"My reason, Pat, not yours," he said.
And he turned and walked lightly toward the door.
"Wait, Tom," she called.
I've got a great idea. There's a new nudie club opening up in Waycross, she grinned. They feature co-ed acts. Why don't you and Andy take that little bump and grind of yours on the road? With her tits and your dick, you'd probably make enough in a week to pay for... There was an explosion of laughter, and I saw Chip and Carter bellowing their glee. Tom nodded affably and went out through the door. I stood breathless with anger, watching Carter and Chip Dabney gasp and mop their steaming eyes and pound each other's shoulders. Don't wait for me, Carter, I said, and went out of the house after Tom Dabney. I hesitated beside the truck.
I thought you'd probably be along, he said. Hop in.
He reached behind the seat and pulled something from the back and tucked it around me. It was the mink throw from his bed at Goat Creek.
It's going to be chilly by the time we get there, he said.
Get where, I said.
King's Oak, he said.
The night was dark and breathed frost, and the skies over the empty winter fields were dusted with stars like silver pepper.
Don't worry about my Uncle Clay or anybody disturbing us. Clay doesn't come into the woods on this night, and he doesn't let anyone else either.
What night is this, I said.
It's the winter solstice, he said. The holiest of all nights. The silence when we got out of the truck at the little clearing on the creek bank was old and clean and immense.
He pulled us across to the island with a few deep, sure thrusts and leaped out into the dark, shallow water and pulled the skiff up onto the bank under the great canopy of the King's Oak. He smiled at me and pulled a cigarette lighter from his pocket and reached down and flicked it, and a wood fire leaped to life.
I came out this afternoon and laid the fire.
Come here, Diana, and let me tell you something, he said, and sank down on the throw beside the fire, holding his hand out to me. I took it, and he pulled me gently down beside him. In the days before recorded history, even, there used to be groves in certain forests that had at their heart one enormous tree. Those groves were sacred to the goddess Diana, the goddess of fertility as well as a goddess of the hunt. They were guarded by a king who was also a priest, and he stayed on watch in the grove and defended it against all comers and served Diana until another man came who was able to fight and kill him. Then he in turn became king. They called him the King of the Sacred Grove, or the King of the Woods, and because she was the goddess of fertility, it said that the king, who was a mortal, was able to take her as a consort and make love to her, and that from that union the sacred grove and the sacred tree drew their blessing for the next year. That union blessed the forest and the animals in it and kept them safe. I began to shake my head back and forth. No, no. Don't you know, he said softly. Didn't you know when you first came to the King's Oak and saw me bring the deer to it? I know you were there. I know you saw me. I felt you there. And didn't you know when we met and you told me your name was Diana? And tonight when you came to the place where I was in your white Greek dress and your laurel crown on the very night of the winter solstice? Didn't you know? Stand up, Diana, he said. If at any time you want to leave, all you have to do is say the word. I'll take you home. But stand up now and let me look at you. He held out his hands, and I took them and let him raise me slowly to my feet. I let my arms fall loosely down to my sides. He came to me and took my face in his hands and kissed me again. You are very beautiful, and you honor this place, he said. And then he reached slowly around me with both hands and found the zipper of the white dress and slid it down. He hooked the waist of my panties, and I stepped out of them. I was naked before him now, in the vast black woods, in the leaping firelight. I watched as he undressed. I always thought it must have happened something like this, he said. I think he must have just wanted to touch her all over a while, to worship her with his hands. And I felt his hands, warm and dry and hard, slide down my cheeks and neck to my shoulders and arms, and then to my waist and along my hips and thighs. Tom, no, wait. I'm afraid, I whispered. But then he took my hands and guided them to the warm hardness of him.
I felt myself fall backwards to the first row and pull him down hard on top of me. And I felt the beginning of that slow, terrible old rhythm that would surely this time blot me out of the world for all eternity. Even as I heard my own cries, yes, go on now, yes, I heard also the intermingling sobbing, I'm afraid, I'm afraid. And heard him soothing, don't be afraid, I'll never hurt you, never. And cried out as loudly as I could, it's me I'm afraid of. Let it go, Diana, he said. You can let go of it now because now I'm here to take it from you. I'm here. And I knew, finally, that I had found the vessel that could catch and hold and transmute the explosive red darkness within me and could pour it back into my body in fire and lightness. And I did let it go and felt the earth and sky and woods and water fly apart, laughing with the force of our coming. Sometime well after dawn, I drifted out of sleep and thought, what I did last night was so terrible, I will not think of it again. I believe I would have slept the day through, except that a great hammering at the cottage door awakened me. Carter and Hillary stood there. Hillary had been crying. May we come in? Carter said. Guilt flooded me. How could I have forgotten that I was to pick up Hillary at Marjorie Chapin's? I'm so sorry, I whispered. You should be sorry, he said. Never mind where you went or what you did with Daphne. You scared your little girl to death. I've been right here, I said. I just didn't hear the phone. I guess Daphne didn't either. I didn't get an answer from him for 4 hours. Finally, I went out there. I was near that Goat Creek last night, I said. I went out to the King's Oak with Tom, and we built a fire and we talked. Tom said just what you said. He said it was up to you to tell me what you did there. So suppose you just do that thing, Andy. Oh, for Christ's sake, Carter. This isn't about Hillary or being worried about me. It's about Tom Dabney and your fucking goddamn pride. How could you sleep through 6 hours of a ringing telephone, he bellowed at me. Did it ever occur to you that that awful exhibition you and Chip put on last night upset me so much that it wore me out? I screamed. Carter, how could you? He was silent for a long time. That's why I called you, to apologize. His voice was so miserable and my own guilt and self-loathing was so complete that I began to cry. After a long time, he put his arms around me. Andy, if you can try to forgive me, I swear I'll never mention him again to you. I'll never doubt you again. Don't, I wept. Don't be nice to me, Carter. I don't deserve it. Shh, he whispered. Of course you deserve it. Who more? I took a long shower and washed my body and hair. We ate omelets in front of the fire and talked of many things, small and of no import. Before he left, he kissed me briefly on the cheek. I stood staring at the closed door and then pulled out the telephone directory and found the number and called Tom at Goat Creek. We have to find a way to forget last night ever happened, I said. Not forget, he said. But we can act as if we have, if that's the way you want it. We can be anything you want. You call the shot. Really? Tom, can we still come strictly as friends? You can count on it, he said. Come on out tomorrow. I've got presents for you and Hillary. He was waiting for us on the porch the next afternoon. Merry Christmas, he said, and we opened our eyes. He stood before us, holding in his hands two slender bows and two quivers of small, slim arrows. I knew he had made them himself. I did not know what to say. Hillary knew. Oh, Tom, they're beautiful, she said. Could I learn to make a bow like this? Sure. I can teach you how to make practically anything you'd need to survive in the wild. And I can teach you to call almost any animal in the Big Silver and to stalk them and shoot them. At the edge of the creek, he had set up a target, the silhouette of a deer. Just wait a minute, I said. I'm not going to shoot at pictures of deer, and I'm not going to have Hillary doing it either. He looked at me for a moment. I think Hillary has the right to pick her own target. I choose the deer, she said promptly. All through the afternoon, they practiced. After 1 hour, she hit the silhouetted deer in the middle of its rump. After three, she hit it cleanly in the middle of the black spot on its chest. We went back to Goat Creek every morning that week, and each day he taught us new things about the woods and waters of the Big Silver. He taught us the talk of the southern swamp animals, the myriad ways to conceal our movements, and he taught us the habits of the animals themselves. He talked to us of the woods, told us strange hunting myths and forest legends. Carter made love to me. He was slow and gentle. He fell asleep beside me in the bed, smiling. I thought, this is good. I don't have to be afraid. He went to the office on New Year's morning. I thought I would spend the morning reading, but at 10, Hillary came briskly into my bedroom in her camouflage clothes and moccasins. We can't go out there every day, Doodle, I said. It's got to be just sometimes. Well, since this is the last day for a while, couldn't we go out and say goodbye to everybody? We could do that, sure, I said. But when we got there, it was to find a cold, closed house and a note on the door. D and H, it read. I've gone up river with Scratch for a while. Call you when I get back. Go get anything you want from the house. It's not locked. I wish he'd taken me, Hillary said desolately. You're 8 years old, I said. Come on, let's get your bow and get on back. The second weekend in January, Clay and Daisy Dabney had a formal dinner dance out at King's Oak. As before, almost everyone I had ever met in Pemberton, and some I had not, were there. I drank a great deal of champagne and danced every dance with Carter and whoever asked me, and I laughed a great deal. You're high as a kite, he grinned. What's with you tonight? I'm happy, I said. I think everybody is wonderful. I think I want another glass of champagne. One more, and then it's ginger ale for you, he said. You're going to have a head like the Goodyear blimp. Go on upstairs and fix your lipstick. You look like you've been in the back of the bus nicking with the entire football team. Don't I wish, I said, and went up the stairs to the second floor bedroom. I went into the bathroom and turned the age-speckled taps, and cold water thundered into the basin. I lowered my face and splashed water on it. When I opened my eyes and looked into the mirror, Tom looked back at me. His eyes were fatigue-shadowed and haunted. Tell me what's wrong, I said. I don't know, he said. I've been up the creek and over the river with Scratch for nearly 2 weeks now. He thinks there's something wrong in the woods. I can't find it, but there's something out of balance. Something bad. It was almost a child's voice. Uncomprehending, fatigued. You're tired, I said. You have to rest now. I thought I would call you in the morning, and if you could make me see I was being a damned fool, he said. But I knew you'd be up here, so I came. I wanted you. I felt a huge, old, sliding weight that pressed down into my groin. Take off those awful clothes, I said hoarsely. I want you to make love to me right now. I shoved the bathroom door shut. He put his hands on my body and he knelt down to go into me. And just before he did, the world exploded again in fire and heat, and he said, I couldn't get to you fast enough. You're here now, I whispered. Oh, God, yes. Now. After we were dressed, he grinned at me. You coming out to Goat Creek tonight, or what, he said. No, I said. I'm going to have to tell Carter. He opened the door and took a step into the bedroom and stopped. Pat Dabney sat slouched in the slipper chair before the dressing table. Evening, folks, she said. If you're looking for Carter, I spec he gone on. He came up here with me, and when he heard all the commotion in the john, he just took off out the door. I stared at her in disbelief. Tom made a low sound of disgust. Somebody's gonna kill you one day, Pat, he said. I turned and went out the bedroom door. He walked softly behind me. I'll take you home. No, I said. Tish and Charlie will take me. The rest of this is between Carter and me. They were waiting for me by the bar, looking worried. Carter thought you'd gone on home, Tish said. He looked awful. Did you two have a fight? No, I said. I'm ready to go when you are. T
Tish and Charlie did not speak until we got to my front door. "Call me tomorrow," Tish called from the car. I halfway expected to see Carter there waiting for me. But the living room was empty. I walked into the bathroom. His terry robe was gone from its hook and his shaving things from the sink. I went back to the living room and looked at my answering machine. The red light was blinking. It was a very short message. "I won't call again," Carter said. "But if you need me, give me a call. I love you, Andy. Take care of yourself." I sat in the wing chair and wept till 3:30. And then, out of tears at last, I went to bed and slept, for the first time in many nights, alone. A couple of weeks after that, Tish went to Atlanta for gum surgery, and I went with her. We drove up on Thursday, and by Saturday night, she felt well enough to go out to dinner. "Are people talking about me?" I asked. "Can you doubt it?" Tish said. "Carter's everybody's darling, and you didn't exactly pick a discreet way to break up with him. And then Carter's back with Pat, and that's going to be good for another 2 months of talk. Not that every woman in town hasn't dreamed of doing it with Tom Dabney in a tree or something. Doing it, though, that's maverick." "They know precious little about me," I said sharply. "I'm the least likely Jezebel in the world. You know that." "Yes," she said, "but remember, all they really know about you is that you've been screwing almost every night since you got to Pemberton. In a town that size, that's pretty spectacular." I lapsed into silence, knowing she was right. I had spent almost the entirety of my new life either thinking about it or doing it. First with Carter, now almost constantly with Tom. And such love. I had not known its like existed. To make love with Tom Dabney was to dive into, to sink, to drown, and to rise again in joy. We ordered dinner, and then Tish said, "There's something else. I've heard a little stuff about black magic or something. I've only heard it from a couple of people, and they got it straight from Pat. She dropped hints about strange rites and, oh, blood sacrifices." "I will kill that poisonous bitch," I said, cold rage almost choking me. "Lord, it's grotesque." Monday night when I saw Tom again, I told him about it. "Tom, why would she say such things?" "I can see why she might," he said. "I think you'd better see, too." He got up and padded to the telephone. "Who are you calling?" I asked. "My accomplices in the black arts," he said. "Reese and Martin and Scratch. It's time for you to learn some other things. I want you to come out late tomorrow, around 8. Leave Hillary with Tish and Charlie and come down to the creek. We'll have a fire going. You'll see it." The next evening, I drove toward Goat Creek in the winter darkness, my heart thumping briskly. To the left of Tom's house, there is a place where Goat Creek narrows to a black ribbon about 4 feet wide. On the near bank now, 2 great fires leaped, and across the creek, Reese and Martin and Tom stood. Scratch Purvis stood alone. They were dressed sensibly, but on their heads each wore a crown of oak leaves. Beside Reese, a small drum sat on the ground, and Martin held his small silver flute. My heart vaulted in my throat. "Diana," Tom said mildly, "we're welcoming you to the woods. I hope you go along with us without questions for a while. If it's too much, I'll walk you to your car. But now's the time to decide, okay?" "Okay," I said. "What do you want me to do?" "Walk between the 2 fires. Then come to the edge of the creek and wait." Reese picked up the little drum and began a small, steady rhythm on it. Martin put the silver flute to his mouth and began to play. The tune was atonal, wailing, hypnotic. Behind him, Scratch sang softly. I came down to where the fires burned, then I walked between them down to the edge of the creek. Something had been built there, a kind of freestanding tunnel of oak and pine boughs. It stood as high as Tom's waist and looked about 5 feet long. "Diana, if you will, come across the creek and through the tunnel," he said. "There's nothing there to hurt you." The flute and drum spiraled up, and Scratch raised his song higher, and I walked into the water of Goat Creek and out again. I looked at Tom. He stood at the other end of the tunnel. I ducked down and entered it. I closed my eyes. I was through the tunnel and standing upright again. Tom held out his hand. He led me before Scratch, then stepped back.
Scratch picked up a small earthenware bowl and dipped his hand into it. He traced something on my forehead. It was cold and wet. I closed my eyes. I did not want to see the color of the liquid on his dark fingers. When I opened them, it was to see Tom lifting a crown of oak leaves to put on my head. He kissed me on both cheeks. "That's it," he said. "Welcome to the woods, Diana Calhoun."
"I... thank you," I said weakly. "Will somebody please tell me what we just did?"
Martin smiled broadly. "What we did was a very old ritual of purification and welcome. It comes basically from the Hindu, who believed that a person must be born again into purity before he can be brought into the group. So an image was made of the female channel of birth, and the uninitiated one had to pass through this birth canal to be regenerated. We make our edifice of oak. When you came through it, you were made new to receive the mysteries of the woods, and you were made safe for contact with our shaman, Scratch. It means you are now one of us. We hope you'll wish to practice with us."
"Practice with you?" I parroted.
"We have a number of rituals that we do to keep the river and woods clean and safe from harm," he said. I stared at him and at Reese and Scratch.
"You worship the woods, then?"
"We don't worship the woods, per se. We try to live sacredly. Somebody, I think Jung, holds that the woods are a metaphor for the most immutable goodness and truth we know, the unconscious. Of course, he called it God, too." I looked up at Tom. His face was relaxed and tranquil.
"I don't think I'm ever going to understand this," I said hopelessly.
Reese spoke up for the first time. "What matters is that you understand why we need it, why somebody has to keep it going. It's an absolute, the last absolute thing we have left. From the first, we've seen what Tom told us you had, a quality of absoluteness yourself, a potential for enormous commitment."
"Then why can't I feel it?" I said desolately.
"You get there," Scratch said. "When you stop being afraid, we gonna help you."
"Does anybody else know that you do these things?"
"Not all of it," Tom said. "Pat knows some of it, and she's taken the boys away from me. I think she'd have me locked up if she could. There are probably lots of other people who would, too, if they really knew what was what. So I have another life, one that passes in the real world." "Tom will most likely be our next shaman," said Reese. "I'm the consigliore. I use what legal knowledge I have when we need to go after the world out there."
"Who would you need to go after? Hunters? Poachers?"
"Sometimes," Reese said. "But mostly the big silver plant."
The dark, complex old fear came flooding back.
I could almost hear my mother's voice.
"There's no safety. Fear everything."
"They told me it was safe," I said in a cold, tight voice. "I don't know that it is dangerous," Reese said. "But the potential for harm is enormous. You know about Three Mile Island, but there's stuff just as bad and worse. There are parts of the country so badly contaminated that they can never be used again. There have been officially designated sacrifice zones. One of those zones is in the Big Silver Swamp. It's been closed till the end of time."
"Nobody told me about that," I said.
"It's a good 20 miles from here," Reese said.
"But do they have some waste on the property?" I prodded.
"Oh, sure. Lots of it," he said. "But it's what they call low level. It's been adjudged safe. The thing that bothers me is the matter of those safe levels. They're government standards, and you couldn't exactly call the government a disinterested party."
"Where do they put it?"
"The waste. There's an area called the burial ground where solid low-level waste is buried in trenches, and tank farms where the heavy stuff, the sludge, is buried. There've been more than 50 million gallons of it generated at the Big Silver. Even with most of it shipped off-site, that leaves a lot of hot shit. The effluent streams run into creeks that feed the Big Silver River in four places, and there's a network of shallow aquifers under the entire acreage that I worry about. And yet, none of them tests over the acceptable limit. I swear I don't see how."
"So you patrol the woods, then? You keep watch?"
"Tom does, mainly," Martin said. "Scratch takes the territory way upriver where Goat Creek makes up. Tom does the rest of the way down in the perimeters of the big silver site.
That's what you do when you're gone in the woods, I said.
Partly, he said. Sometimes I go do a purification or to clean. Or I look for things that need taken care of. I just do my own land. Scratch does King's Oak, and I don't go on Big Silver land.
After they left, we sat in front of the fire and drank brandy.
Scratch is the best of us. In another time, he would have been a king. The really natural ones, like Scratch, come along about once a century.
Hillary could be one, I think.
Tom, get this clear right now, I said. I will not have one word, not one iota of this told to her. I have to have your promise on that.
You have it, he said.
We were silent for a moment. Then I said, I can learn the myths and woods knowledge. But, Tom, I don't think I'm ever going to understand why it's important.
It's a matter of kinship, he said.
Literal kinship with the trees and the animals and the living water of the creeks and rivers.
Is it a matter of belief? Like a religion?
No, he said. It's a matter of consciousness.
Where you see life energy, there you see consciousness.
That's what it means to live wild.
So you think you understand the deer you kill?
It's more than that, he said. It's that somehow I become them.
How can you kill something you can understand like that?
Because that's the way of the wild.
And so you wipe blood on yourself and you ask his forgiveness to get off the hook?
It's more than that. It's to make his death sacred, meaningful in the highest sense. We were silent for a long time, the dying fire snapping and whispering.
Come on, lady, he said.
Let's dance. I need to give thanks.
Who do you thank, Tom?
He looked at me. I thank all of this. This night, and the firelight, and all the years I've got left to live. The wonderfulness of everything. The fact of it.
Well then, Tom Dabney, I said, getting to my feet.
Let's dance. After that night, we were together most of the time. I laughed a great deal and sang in the evenings when Tom brought out the marten before the fire. I learned as never before. He taught me to stalk and shoot the bow and arrow creditably well, and I became quite accurate with a little Ruger he gave me. I began to be able to read the woods. And, oh, Hillary! It seemed she was a creature of dappled light and green silence, as natural in the woods as a young doe.
Look mighty pretty to me, Scratch said.
Hillary had fallen in love with Scratch, and as often as she went out into the river swamp with Tom, even more often did she go with Scratch Purvis. Her eyes spilled over with the fullness of a child who knew herself to be the center of the universe. For the first time in her young life, my daughter was not afraid of anything or anyone in her world. Our lives slipped with the big silver swamp into spring. The earth and water and sky went suddenly tender and milky with richness. There seemed to be a luminous mist in the woods. Despite the beauty of the woods, it was not a very good spring. Scratch was thinner and more stooped.
He's sick, Tom said one of those nights.
I don't know why he's being so stubborn about seeing a doctor.
He told me he'd go, Hillary piped up.
But right now he's got something he's got to do.
In the last week of April, Scratch told Tom about seeing a sick deer up by the King's Oak. That night, Tom told me that he was going to track and kill the animal that weekend. He thinks it has something to do with this famous lights in the water. He's seeing them up creek.
I don't like the sound of that, I said. I hope he hasn't said anything to Hillary about it.
No, I told him not to. Don't worry about it. It's marsh gas.
I hope you're right, I said.
Tom, why is it you're willing to accept almost any myth about the woods except this one about the creek water?
I guess it's because water is the most sacred thing. Water is the mother and the redeemer. If I have a real and abiding terror, it's of something spoiling the water.
Anyway, he said, I'm going to go up and take a Saturday early if I can.
and I'll do a cleansing ritual. I think it's time now for you to come with me. That Saturday I got to Goat Creek before sunup. Before a kill and a cleansing, it's important to be quiet and go inside yourself and bring the animal in with you, he said. He slipped his bow and arrow quiver over his shoulder and strapped one of the cruel hunting knives onto his belt. He lifted my little Ruger off the wall rack and handed it to me. Before a sacred kill, we sing a praise song to the animal so he will know that we honor and revere him. We dedicate our weapons only to honorable death. We went out into the pearl morning. The white silver of a late April dawn was just flushing through the trees. He moved off into the edge of the forest and was gone, and I went in behind him. For the first time, I felt the woods close around me and swallow me as I had seen them do to him. I could have shouted aloud with the exultation of it. We walked for more than an hour. 5 minutes past the King's Oak, Tom suddenly froze ahead of me. In slow motion, Tom drew an arrow from his quiver and fitted it into his bow. He went into a crouch. It was only when he began a murmured incantation that I saw them, a file of 5 silent deer. The last one moved slowly and jerkily, her head down. I knew this was the doe Tom had come to take. I closed my eyes. I heard the thunk twang of the bowstring, and then I heard her fall. He knelt and turned the little doe over on her back, and I gasped with shock and horror. The silvery white belly was hideously disfigured with great bulging tumors and blackened open sores. I had never seen anything remotely so horrible before. This was no disease of nature. Tom took the doe and dragged her back into the underbrush. I could see the glint of tears on his face. I stood up and went after him. No, he flung over his shoulder. I have to do this by myself. I believed that he buried her there. I heard him moving rhythmically in the undergrowth, as if he were dancing. He chanted, too, a dirge of grief, of old woe. It was nearly noon when he came back. Something is wrong out here, he said. There's something in the swamp. It's the goddamn plant. It's the big silver. Fear so powerful it almost dropped me, struck again. You can't be serious, I said. The water, he said. It would be the groundwater. They cool the waste with water. They bury hot waste in pits that leach into streams. They've been lying to us for years. They must be. But I'll find where it's coming from. And then I'm going to stop it. I'll blow the fuck up if I have to. Tom, I said loudly, don't do anything stupid. Go talk to their public relations people or your Uncle Clay. Go through channels, in other words, he said softly. You saw that doe. That's your precious real world. How did you like that? Oh, don't talk to me about the real world, I cried. You say you renounce it, you won't live in it, but you damned well do. You get your living from it, your friends, and your books and music. You think you're such a goddamn purist, Tom, but you haven't given up anything. You get to romp naked around Eden without a Tyrannosaurus Rex nipping at your ass. Big deal, Tom. Your trouble, Diana, he said slowly and coldly, is that you are not willing to die for anything. You don't have the least idea what it means to be truly outraged, to feel the pure power and rightness of passion and irrationality and total commitment. Those things scare you to death. You've spent half a year running from them in me, and your whole life running from them in you. But they're down there, Diana. In your deepest heart, you're just what I am, and I am a madman and a lunatic and all those things the world calls a man who is willing to live for what he believes and to kill for it and to die himself for it. You are crazy, I screamed at him. Yes, he shouted back. I am crazy. All this time you've been fucking a crazy man out here in the swamp. You weren't scared then. You got off on it, Diana. I pulled my arm back and slapped him. Don't you ever call me Diana again, I cried. I'm not your goddamn fucking hunk goddess. I did not marry you under the fucking sacred oak. I'm Andy Panopoulos Calhoun, and if you ever call me Diana again, I'll kill you. We looked at each other for a long moment, and then he wheeled on his soft moccasins and was gone into the woods. I called after him. There was no answer. I'd known there would not be. Presently, feeling as hollow as the core of a dead planet, I picked up the little rifle and set off. When I came wearily into the yard, the house was closed and his truck was gone, and no smoke curled into the washed April sky. I stood the separation for most of a week, and then I went back to Goat Creek. It seemed to me that I had simply and terribly overreacted to his grief and rage. But he was not there. The house was dark and locked, and the truck was gone. For days after that, I lived in a sweat of apprehension, afraid almost to turn on the evening news or pick up the telephone when it rang. After another week, I stopped being so afraid that he had gone into the Big Silver Plant woods to do harm. But I did not see him again at school, or Martin either, and I did not see Reese. The anxiety slid into a kind of inert heaviness. Hillary did not ask after Tom, but she read the trouble that clung to me. She went silent and still, and her quicksilver energy drained away. Tish came into the living room of the cottage on an evening at the end of May. I told her about Tom's anguish and fury, and what he had said about the Big Silver Plant, and how very afraid I was of that thing in him that shimmered wild without limits of any kind. "Well, he's always been that way, Andy. This absoluteness that he has. You can turn it inside against yourself, make it a weapon. Then you have a madman or a criminal. Or you can turn it outside and use it as a battering ram to break down walls and silence. Then you have a saint. Nobody is sure which it's going to be with Tom." The week before Hillary and I had our birthdays, Tom came back. The spring session at Pemberton State had ended, but one morning I saw his truck in the parking lot. All that morning I waited, but he did not call. By that weekend I was drowned in pain, but also secure in the certainty that he would not call, and that it was indeed over. I knew I would not call him now. Summer came. Hillary waited. She did not speak of the dreammaker, but in the late nights she played his song. On a night of thick, thunderous air and shimmering heat lightning off to the west, my doorbell rang. When I opened it, a gust of sweet, fresh wind came in ahead of the storm, and Tom Dabney came in with it. He wore what appeared to be a doublet and hose and a silk tunic. He held a scroll in his hand. It was exquisitely calligraphed in black ink. "May I come in?" he said. My heart began to pound. He handed me the scroll. "I wish you'd read it," he said. "It took me hours to compose it." I held up the scroll and read it. It said, "Summer is e-comin' in, louder sing cuckoo. Groweth seed and bloweth mead, and his birthday comes, speed, sing cuckoo." I turned it over. The same exquisite cursives bade me to attend an evening of drama in verse to celebrate mine and Hillary's birthdays at Tom's house. "I've been working on this for 2 weeks," Tom said. "If you won't come, then I'll cut my throat. I'm an awful asshole. It's easier for me to mount a full-fledged Elizabethan verse production than to say I'm sorry. But if you need for me to say that, I will. Please come to your party, Andy. I've missed you." I began to laugh and cry at the same time. "I've missed you too, you damned fool," I sobbed. "I'd love to come to my party." It was only much later that I remembered that he had not called me Diana. On the way out to Goat Creek on the day of the party, Hillary burned like a blue flame, happiness pouring out of her like spring water. "I just knew," she said, "I knew we'd be coming back to Goat Creek." Tom was sitting on the porch steps with Earl on his shoulder. "I've missed you, Princess," he said to Hillary. "Missy is almost pined away now. She won't eat a bite." I was shocked at Missy's appearance. She seemed much thinner, and her taupe coat looked rough and without luster. "I really think it's that she's missed Hill," he said. "Scratch can't find anything, and he's seen every goat disease known." Scratch was in the kitchen stirring a great kettle. Scratch's head seemed to me positively skull-like, and it shook gently as did his papery, white-dusted old hands. Foreboding hit me squarely. Surely that was illness. "Take care of yourself," I said. "I can hear you breathing."
"It's just a cold," he said. "Got it up creek fishing." "I'm glad to hear that's all you were doing," I said. "So you thought we were out blowing up the Big Silver," Tom said a while later. "Well, the thought did occur. What were you doing up there, Tom, or should I ask?" "Sure," he said. "The first thing we did was have Reese check every soil and water test at every station around the swamp and on the river. Absolutely nothing there. But we did a cleansing anyway. Took 3 days. Scratch says it's clean, if... or whatever it was a one-shot thing. It was a very powerful cleansing."
"And can you just leave it alone now?" I said.
"I have," he said.
I will never forget that night. It belongs in the pantheon of perfect times. Tom was everywhere, laughing, teasing, singing. Hillary shone like a new young sun.
"It don't get any better than this, does it?" Tom said to me as he whirled his Aunt Daisy past.
"No," I said, sudden tears swelling in my throat. "It don't." After the dancing, Tom came to stand by me.
"Ladies and gentlemen," he shouted, "I bid you gather in the great hall and let the games begin."
While the actors scurried into Tom's bedroom to get ready for the performance, Tom did an extraordinary juggling act with Earl. There was laughter and whistles and applause. And then the play. It was formal and faultless in form. It told the story of Hillary's and my coming to Pemberton, and of my courtship by Tom, and an imagined marriage. I realized about halfway through that the play was a proposal of sorts. I was not surprised, and I had no more doubts as to what my reply would be. When the play ended, the applause went on and on. I looked around the room. All the faces there were suffused with the nearest thing I had ever seen to mass joy. Tish and Charlie were the last guests out. They drove away, and Martin and Reese started into the kitchen. Tom waved them off.
"Go on home," he said. "Nobody should have to wash dishes after a night like this. We'll do it in the morning."
They went without further protest. I knew they wanted to leave Tom and me alone. We sat down on the sofa in front of the fireplace, and he poured us a cognac. In the moonlight, he looked fabulous and beautiful, and I knew that I wanted him with every atom of my being.
"I'm sorry about that day, Andy. But you need to know all of me," he said. "I'm not a rational man. I can be at times, but I'm other things, too. Would you really rather I was tame?" "Oh, no, my love," I said into his ear. "I don't want you tame."
Later that night, I had a dream. I was watching Hillary riding in a horse show, taking jump after jump with exquisite precision. I was part of a large crowd that clapped and cheered for her. In the dream, my heart began to pound with fear for her. She was going too high. Soon she would fall. The cheers turned to screams, and then became Hillary's screams. I sat up, my heart about to suffocate me. The screaming did not stop. I was off the couch and at the door of her room before I even realized that I had stood up, and I could hear Tom stirring behind me. The room was empty. The screaming came again, from somewhere down by the creek. I stumbled out onto the porch. Scratch was making his way painfully toward where my daughter stood in the shallow water of Goat Creek, in the spot where she had danced in the healing moonlight with Tom Dabney. The water covered her ankles, and she stood in it and screamed and screamed and screamed. At her feet, the small form of the kid jerked and spasmed in a terrible convulsion.
"The fire! The fire! The water's on fire!" Hillary screamed.
And as I stared, I saw it. Down the creek, a bluish glow lit the black water. A thin, steady, malignant glow, as if someone had dropped a tube of blue neon into it, and it lay on the bottom, shining mindlessly on and on. A blue light in the water, and from its surface, like smoke, the thin, vaporous steam of hot water. Tom nearly knocked me down as he ran past me down the steps and down to the creek bank, but not before I had seen his face. I ran across the snake-cold grass to his side. I looked at my child, and the little goat, and the shining, smoking water, and up at Tom. His face, as he lifted the rifle to shoot the dying animal, was that of a man who had looked into hell. 2 nights after the horror on the bank of Goat Creek, I woke at dawn, and before awareness had claimed me fully, I knifed myself into a fetal knot and wept with a grief and fear and desolation I had not felt in all of adulthood. In the pillow, I heard myself scream aloud, "I want my daddy! I want my daddy!" Presently, I felt my shoulder being shaken, and I heard Hillary keening above me like a little animal in a trap. "No, Mama, no, Mama." I struggled to sit upright and take her into my arms. She shook all over like a child in the grip of a convulsion. "It was just a nightmare, darling," I said in as steady a voice as I could manage. She stopped the terrible quivering, but the keening slid over into a repetition of my own litany. "I want my daddy. Oh, I want my daddy. I want him." And my heart split with a thunderbolt of agony. He had beaten her mother and killed her puppy and crushed her heart and soul almost beyond healing. And my child wept for her father, seeing in her entire gray, howling world no one else who could or would help her, feeling in my own arms no healing and no refuge. But under the pain I felt a small, rude spike of hope. She had spoken words. Since I had brought her home from Goat Creek 2 days before, still screaming, Hillary had not spoken. She stayed in her room with her door closed. Most of the time when I eased the door open to look in on her, she was heavily asleep. Once or twice I had found her sitting up in bed writing in one of her school notebooks. When the incantatory, "I want my daddy," finally slowed, I lifted her blotched and swollen face to mine. "Would you just listen to us," I said. "Both of us sitting here like 2-year-olds, hollering for our daddies." "You scared me," she said. "I knew your daddy was dead. I thought you meant you wanted to be dead, too, so you could see him." "Oh, poor sweetie," I said, holding her heart against me again. "Not ever for one single second would I want to be dead and leave you alone. It's just that grown-ups have nightmares, too. It doesn't mean anything. I can just wake up and take care of myself. And I can take care of you, too." "You can't stop the bad things from happening, though," she said. I thought of the things in Hillary's life that I had not indeed been able to stop. Loss, fear, death. I knew then that that was what she had meant when she wept for her father, and what I had meant, too. We had both wept for the terrible knowledge that sooner or later you cried out in terror and need, and nobody was there but you. She had discovered that at far too early an age. Even I had not fully known it until the 40th year of my life. Even before, in the tree stand at King's Oak, I had eventually stopped crying and sat still and waited for someone to come for me. And Tom Dabney had come. But I could not let him come to me now, and I could not go to him. Now there was only me. I was alone, and Hillary had only me. For the rest of that morning and afternoon, I waited for the news of Tom. I saw him on the 6 o'clock pickup out of Atlanta. When I saw his face, a banshee's mask, I felt the deepest and most hopeless grief. "Oh, my dear love, you're gone now," I said silently. Tom was on the sheriff's doorstep when the office opened, demanding an investigation of the Big Silver plant and threatening violence. He drove out to the plant. He bullied his way into Francis Milliken's office, almost tossing his secretary to the floor, shouting and raging. From there he drove back to Goat Creek and called the State Patrol, the Pemberton Police, the Environmental Protection Agency, the Greenpeace representatives, his senator and congressman. By noon he had a gallon jug of water from Goat Creek in the truck and was on his way to a private laboratory in Atlanta with it. He called the Atlanta newspapers and television stations. One or two got him on tape, and one aired the segment on the 6 o'clock news. By the time Tom was back in Pemberton, there was a warrant out for his arrest on charges of disturbing the peace and bodily assault. Francis Milliken filed it on behalf of himself and the furious secretary. Before Clay could post his bail, Tom had spent a night in the county jail. By the next morning, the news was on everybody's lips. Tom Dabney had gone as crazy as a loon and was threatening to get the Big Silver closed. When the report came back from the laboratory showing astronomically high levels of plutonium, cesium, and strontium-90, he called Francis Millikan, walked into his office, and threw the report on the desk, announcing that he was going to the Environmental Protection Agency and the media. It was the stupidest thing he had ever done in his life. By the time the EPA and the media arrived at the Big Silver the next day, the report had vanished, and the lab in Atlanta disclaimed any knowledge of Tom Dabney and a jar of water from Goat Creek. Tom went to Clay then. Clay offered to find an independent engineer and proposed to the Big Silver management that this man run his own check of conditions. Will you trust me to do this, Tom? Yes. Oh, okay, I guess so. Clay looked at him a long time and then sighed heavily. You have my promise about going after them if my man finds anything out there. After that, the furor subsided a bit, but Tom grew silent and hollow-eyed and no longer hunted or fished. There were fish kills, but there were no more cleansing rituals. Several of the goats were sick, too. All this I learned from Reese's comedy. He needs you, Andy, Reese said. He won't let us near him, but I think he would you. I can't, I said. Reese, he's right about the water. And Tom has gone beyond where I can follow. My daughter is hurt in her heart, and if she's hurt one more time, she'll die from it. I see, Reese said. Let me ask you one thing. Do you love Tom? Yes, I said. But it doesn't make any difference. If it doesn't, then nothing does, Reese said, and went away. Then nothing does, I said into the air of the empty living room. But I knew that that was not true. Hillary made a difference, and Hillary was no longer anyone I knew. She spoke only when spoken to, but in as few words as possible. She would drink only the bottled water, and would take only sponge baths and water that had been boiled. She spent her time in her room with the door only slightly ajar, writing in her notebooks with a concentration that was altogether adult and more than a little frightening. She never spoke Tom's name. I think it's called lack of effect, Tish said once during those first weeks. You have to get her to a good shrink. There's one in Waycross. I hear he's absolutely marvelous with kids. We saw him last Tuesday, I said. His name is Frick Harper. He seems to think she'll eventually be okay. He has on a new antidepressant that doesn't have many side effects. He said the silent treatment was fairly standard for the kind of trauma she's been through in the last year. Did you tell him everything? Tish said cautiously. I told him about Tom. He said stability and quiet are the ticket now. He suggested it would not be such a good idea for her to be around Tom. Well, he's the doctor, she said doubtfully. But I still don't think Tom is crazy. Tish, he's been to jail, I said. He goes around ranting like a madman on TV. He almost knocked Francis Millikan down. Knocking Francis Millikan down is crazy? Tish grinned. Look, I know he's acting crazy. I just don't think he is crazy. Okay, I'm finished. I'm out the door. But Andy, if Charlie and I can help... I know, I said. I love you, Tish. I went to her and hugged her, and she was gone, shutting the burning day out behind her. I went into Hillary's room. She was asleep on the rumpled bed, her notebook on the spread beside her. I looked down. On the cover, Hillary had written, in a creditable attempt at calligraphy, the true story of Tom Dabney. I went back into the living room and lay down on the sofa and cried for a long time. The engineer Clay promised duly appeared early next week. I met him at the inn, Tish reported. His name is Tim Ford. He's attached to some kind of water research institute that's a model for the whole country. Well, more power to him, I said. I hope to God he can clear this up. It was good news we got from Tim Ford. He found nothing. I don't believe that, Tom said when Clay telephoned him. Tom, we had a deal, his uncle said. I'll honor it until I can't anymore, Uncle Clay, Tom said. But I don't believe that water is clean. Tom honored his word to Clay for 8 more days. On the 8th day, he went into the woods.
4 miles upstream, he found a dead 6-month-old doe, hideously deformed. Martin Longstreet told me about it. He's got him out a guerrilla campaign against the Big Silver Plant, he said.
And he did. The next day, teenagers and a few blacks from the settlement far up Goat Creek appeared on the main streets of Pemberton carrying signs saying, Big Silver is killing you. Tom hired a small Cessna and a pilot to fly over the downtown area every day at noon for the next 3 weeks. Its trailing banner said, Big Silver is killing you. Effigies of Francis Millican and various government and Stratton Fournier officials cropped up on the lawns of City Hall and the Inn, each bearing a sign that said, Big Silver is killing you.
By midsummer, Tom had begun to slide over into darkness. He began to patrol the boundary fence of the Big Silver plant night after night, wearing a camouflage hunting shirt, hunting pants, deerhide moccasins, and a garland of oak leaves on his head. He carried one of his willow bows and a quiver of arrows and a hunting knife. Once a small security patrol came face to face with him in the dark. He was, the unnerved patrol said, striped and dabbled with fresh blood. I began to hear talk that a move was afoot to have him voluntarily committed to a psychiatric facility. Tish told me sorrowfully that he had become a ghastly parody of himself. A ragged, obsessed laughingstock. By now, she said, all of his allies except Clay Dabney were gone. Martin had retreated back to his little apartment, his own job said to be in jeopardy. Reese drifted gently in a Stolichnaya bottle. Scratch hardly ever left his bed in the cabin up Goat Creek now. He needs somebody, Tish, I said. It might even help him stop all this. It can't be me, but it could be you. Just talk to him. I watched Tish's plain, good face as the light went out of it. I can't. I have to have rules and a context, even if they're outrageous, scandalous rules. Tom has gone beyond rules. And I went away knowing that she was right, and that he had. I was weak and cold with dread for Hillary. She grew listless about her schoolwork and silent in school. She stopped eating and lost weight. Now Frick Harper even spoke of a possible short stay in a good psychiatric facility if she did not improve.
Oh, God, I whispered in terror. I can't put her in a mental hospital.
You may have to, he said. As things grew worse with Hillary, Tish and Charlie grew close. Other friends from whom I had not heard since the first day of Tom's siege of Pemberton called in concern for my daughter. Carter brought a new riding habit by and hugged me wordlessly. She was ill, and I was frightened. The day that her summer term ended, a letter came from Chris's lawyer in Atlanta. Chris had finished his program of therapy, and he had remarried a young woman who was a juvenile nurse practitioner. Her name was Dawn, and she was warm and caring and experienced with troubled youngsters, and eager to get acquainted with Chris's daughter. If I could see my way clear to letting Hillary come to Atlanta and visit her father and his wife on a one-time basis, everyone would be very grateful. Chris was not the same man he had been. I called Frick Harper. I don't think it's a bad idea at all, he said, providing she wants to go. I'll ask her then, I said coolly, sure that Hillary would refuse. But Hillary did not refuse. I'd like to go, my daughter said, not looking at me. All right, I said. After that, she was just the slightest bit better. I set the date through Chris's lawyer and made the arrangements. Come on, said Tish. It's not like she was going for a year. It's just 10 days. We'll do lots of stuff. Maybe we'll run down to the beach. You're scared she's going to like her father again, or even love him. But shouldn't she? Hasn't that been part of the problem all along? That's not it at all, I said, knowing that in part it was. She needs consistency and constancy. Right now, I'm the only constant in her life. You sure it's not more like she's the only one in yours, Tish said? Maybe you both ought to learn that the only really constant is yourself. I really hate you when you get all sage and earth-motherly, I said. Me too, she said equably. 2 days after Hillary left for Atlanta, Tish's mother fell and broke a hip, and Tish and Charlie left to go to Macon. Please go on down to the cottage, she said. I don't think you ought to stay there by yourself right now.
Why on earth not? I said, ignoring a strange finger of something that felt very like fear probing coldly in my stomach. Rest is what will be good for me. I swallowed hard. What on earth was the matter with me? What was there to be afraid of? Hillary's therapist had assured me she was safe. Was, in fact, a good bit improved. Well, I'll call and check on you every day, Tish said. When I'd hung up the phone, I sat for a moment, looking blindly around the room. My heart escalated its pounding, and my palms were wet. I felt something huge and black and formless crouching at the fringes of my mind. I could not have said what I was afraid of. I was simply inside an endless cyclone, an earthquake of fear. I gasped and shook all over. I was absolutely sure that I was dying. I reached for the telephone and dialed Frick Harper's number. Mercifully, he was still in his office. I think I'm dying, I whispered. Help me, Frick. I think I'm going to die. Panic attack, he said, when I'd finally stopped gasping into the phone. World class. I should have warned you. I should have thought you'd be a prime candidate once Hillary left. Frick, it was more than just some kind of anxiety thing, I said. It was unspeakable. If it happens again, it will kill me. No, it won't, he said. Just think for a minute what you've lost. And in a short time. Your husband, your home, your security. And now the person you've been living for every second of your life. For almost a year. Do you still have that Xanax I gave you for Hillary? Take two right now and then one every 6 hours and call me tomorrow. Chances are they'll do the trick. But I wish you'd let me send you to somebody and get started working on all that unresolved garbage you've been carrying around. Maybe later, I said. Maybe when school starts again. I went and got the Xanax out of my medicine chest and took two. I washed them down with scotch. In a few moments, I fell asleep on the couch, all the lamps blazing. When the pounding at the door finally reached me, I struggled to a sitting position and called out, "Who is it?" "It's Tom. Can I come in? I need to talk to you." I went to the door and stood looking at him through the screen. He was thin to bone. Silently, I unhooked the screen door, and he came into the room. We sat opposite each other in front of my dead fireplace. "What is it, Tom?" "It's Scratch," he said, and grief was heavy in his voice. "Andy, he's just eaten up." I went over and sat on the arm of his chair and put my arms around him. "He came dragging up on the porch tonight and collapsed. He had a hemorrhage. I never saw so much blood. Oh, Christ, Andy. On his neck and head. The tumors. The sores. Like the deer." "I took him to the emergency room, but it isn't going to do any good."
"What is it?" I whispered.
"Cancer," he said. "I should have known all along. It's the motherfucking murdering water, of course. Scratch never would drink city water. Andy, I need for you to come with me now. I can't ask anybody else."
"Where?" I said. "Where?"
"Back up the creek to the lumber camp on King's Oak," he said. "Andy, he told me that whatever is in the water is coming from that camp. I'm going up there tonight. I need you to come with me."
"Are you telling me that it's something Clay is doing?" I whispered.
He shook his head. "I don't know."
"But can't you see? I have to find out." "Andy, Jesus, please."
His voice broke again and tears ran down his face. My thinking mind switched off, and the old thing there, the old, deep, simple thing that had once called out to Tom and been answered by him, lurched and ground and lumbered back to life. "Fix yourself a drink," I said. "I'll be just a minute." We drove through the hot, moon-thick night mostly in silence. Once he turned his head to look at me and said, "I can't tell you this is not dangerous." "I'm not afraid," I said serenely, and realized that I was not. I turned my head to look through the rear window and saw the gleam of dark metal. On the ledge behind the seat lay two rifles, his DD single shot and my slim little Ruger. "You're not taking your bow," I said. "You haven't done any kind of ceremony, have you?" "I thought for something like this..." The bow and the rituals and all that jazz haven't done any of us a whole hell of a lot of good, have they? He said, briefly and flatly. All of it that we believed and loved couldn't help the woods. Couldn't heal the water. And Scratch. I couldn't even save Scratch.
Tom.
No. I'm sorry, but we can't talk about that anymore. I can still stop it. I'm as good with a gun as I was with a bow and arrow. Or a fucking chant. After a space of silence, we reached the turnoff for King's Oak, and he slowed the truck and turned in. We're going up creek from here, he said. About 3 miles up creek, we'll cut up a little branch that forks off to the left. It runs right through the lumber company's main clearing, and on up to where the creek makes up. Andy, God, don't let me down now. This is the end of it. This is where we start to stop it, if it can be stopped. This is for Hillary. Do it for Hillary and yourself. Let's go then, I said. We walked steadily for over an hour. I forgot pain and fear. The night woods swallowed me and were, for a small space of time, all. We came to the tiny branch that cut off to the left through the woods. Tom stopped, and I looked ahead into the darkness. It's okay, he said. I don't think there's anybody up there. He handed my rifle to me. Don't use it unless I tell you. Or unless I can't help you anymore. Then use it instantly. You know how. We came to a place where a fence of rusted wire bisected the branch and ran off into the darkness on either side. Tom stopped. Beyond that, it's lumber company land, he said. We'll have to go under it. He wriggled under and held the wire for me. After I was under and upright again, we went on. Stay here, Tom whispered, and moved off toward the light. In what seemed an eternity, but was more likely 5 minutes or so, I heard him call my name. Andy. There was something wrong with his voice. I ran into the clearing. It was large, perhaps the area of 4 football fields. The floor of the clearing was weed-choked white sand, and a spur rail line ran through it, running out of sight into the trees on both sides. A staggering row of utility lights circled the clearing. At first, I did not see Tom, and then I heard him call again and saw him, a small figure at the very end of the clearing on the far side. I followed the spur line to where he stood. It ended there. I saw what it ended in before I came near to it, and could not make myself go further. 4 vast square concrete pools lay at the end of the spur. Around them, the forest stretched away black and old and silent. Beyond them, the spur line picked up again and ran off toward Goat Creek and the Big Silver River. They were filled with a terrible, opaque, green-white liquid, and smoke and vapor lay so thickly over them that I could see their surfaces only intermittently. But I could make out that the surfaces were in motion of themselves. They writhed and bubbled and sucked. When the vapors parted, I could see that deep down, far down, the pools were an eldritch, burning blue. "What is it?" I whispered. "What in the name of God is it?" "Seepage basins," he said. "Seepage basins. Cooling pools. Whatever, for nuclear waste." I saw 26 others just like them over at the Big Silver plant. I've been over there scouting. 26 just like these 4. Only they kept those cleaned up. They weren't boiling. They weren't lit up. No wonder they test clean. This is where they put the worst of it. The stuff that tests out of sight with plutonium and strontium and God knows what else. The stuff that kills you. They're dumping wastewater up here on King's Oak. And more than water, I'll bet my life. I'll bet if we looked, we'd find tank fields for sludge and salts, and pools where they dump the radioactive hardware and tools and clothes, and maybe even the irradiated fuel and target rods. That's what lights the water up blue. The rods! He swung around to face me, and I saw that his open eyes were totally mad. "They're not lumbering up here," he said. "They've been hauling it in here for God knows how long. They can ship directly in here, in tank cars, and nobody even knows the hell they're doing it, because nobody ever comes in here. What do you want to bet that there hasn't been a log or a drop of turpentine out of here in Christ knows how many years?" "How dare they," I said in a low, shaking voice. Stupid, stupid, how dare they? How dare we? Look what we've all been given, and look what they've done to it, and what we've let them do. Oh, how dare we? God should kill us in all our arrogant stupidity. There isn't any God, Tom said. We've killed sacredness, too.
I put my arms around him. We have to go to Clay, I said. Clay will know what to do.
No, Tom said. Clay knows. This is his land. There's no way he couldn't know.
In all my life, I will only remember snatches of the terrible journey back to King's Oak. The big house was dark, but when we pulled up, Clay Dabney stood there waiting for us. We went up the steps, and Tom stood facing his uncle.
We've just been up to the lumber yard, Tom said.
Clay nodded.
Yes, he said. I wondered when you'd get up there.
Clay, he said. Uncle Clay, please, I just need to know why.
Shit, you've got all the money you'll ever need. Why did you have to let them pay you to poison it?
Clay?
Clay, do you know that some of that stuff takes 400,000 years to go dormant? You knew about the woods. You were one of us. You desecrated sacred ground. You know what Oppenheimer said when he saw the first atomic bomb explode? He said, I have become death, the destroyer of worlds. That's you, Clay. Death, the destroyer of worlds.
Clay Dabney's white face twisted. It was legal. A straight business contract.
His voice trailed off.
I think my father would kill you, Tom said softly.
Your father was crazy as hell, Clay shouted. And you're crazy, too. Playing goddamn King of the Sacred Grove all your lives, while I went to work and made enough money to keep King's Oak in the family. Christ, it's just dirt. It's just swamp water. They're just goddamn deer. They ain't gods. I kept the fucking taxes paid on this damned land and kept the land in this damned family. How would you like me to have made the money to do that, Tom? Sell it off piece by piece for a strip shopping center? Put a fucking ball bearing plant on it? This way not a single tree went down, hardly. I didn't know the fucking stuff was leaking out. I didn't know it was poison.
Clay,
get the stuff out of there starting tomorrow. And bury those pools 10 feet deep in clean dirt, or I will go to the newspapers and the television stations, and then I will come back and kill you. And it will be a sacred act of vengeance.
He whirled and walked away toward the car. Tom turned then and looked at his uncle.
It was Chip, wasn't it, Clay? It wasn't you. It was Chip. Chip cut a deal with who? Francis Millikan? I should have known right away when I saw it.
He turned and stumbled back to the truck, and I went lurching after him. I opened the door on the passenger side and half lifted him into it and got in the driver's side and started the truck. I turned toward Goat Creek. Don't you want to go home, he said. There was no substance to his voice. I am going home, I said. My arms, as I helped him out of the truck and up the wide porch, were steady. I let him sag down on the bed. I flung off my filthy clothing and climbed in. I held him, watching the moon sink to meet the tops of the still trees across my daughter's Moon River. Then he turned and said, "It's all gone, Andy. I didn't heal it. All this time, what I thought we could do, it was just crazy men mouthing crazy words, dancing and singing in the woods like savages, killing good animals who should have lived. Clay was right. There isn't any power. It's just dirt. They're just trees."
"Hush," I said. "You're tired to very death. You aren't making any sense. There is power. I've seen you use it. And if it isn't the power you thought it was, what difference does it make? Beauty has power. Peace and silence and wildness have power. Love has great power. Isn't that enough? You still have all those things. You have Hillary and me."
"I don't have you," he said dully. "You were always afraid. And you were right to be. And Hillary is gone."
"No, she isn't," I said. "She never was. She always believed. She still does. She wrote a book, Tom, and it's called The True Story of Tom Dabney.
I felt him smile. And then the smile was gone. I'm really afraid now, Andy. I don't know what the water has done to my body. I don't know what it would do to you. I'm not afraid, I said fiercely. I'm not afraid of the water. I'm not afraid of you. I'm not afraid of anything about your body. I will never be afraid. Make love to me, Tom, right now. He rolled away from me. No, he said in a strangled voice. I can't. Only when I heard his breathing go deep and even did I let the monstrous white fatigue take me under too. As I did it, I thought how very seductive it would be just not to wake up again. I did, of course. When I did, my hand reached for Tom as it had many times before in this bed. Memory and his absence from it hit me at the same time. But even before I saw that the pegs that held his bow and quiver of arrows were empty, I knew that he was gone and where. I ran to the telephone and found and dialed Chip Dabney's number. It would be Chip. Tom would go for Chip first. Lucy Dabney's sleepy voice answered. Lucy, where's Chip? He's gone out to the plantation. Tom called a while ago and said for Chip to meet him. I told him to call his daddy and tell him... Call Clay now, I cried and slammed the phone down. I scrambled into my filthy clothes and shoes, snatched my rifle from its rack and ran blindly out of the house. I leaped into the creek and plunged into the undergrowth heading upstream. I came out on the bank of Goat Creek, just across from the small island where the King's Oak stood. I shook the sweat from my eyes, fingers rigid around the stalk of the Ruger. Clay was standing straight and still, and was wearing nothing at all but a rough crown of oak leaves. I looked up into the canopy of the King's Oak. Chip was there in the tree stand, crouched in a tight knot on the floor of the stand. Clay was staring straight across the creek at a point on the bank just opposite him. Slowly I turned to follow his gaze. Tom stood there naked, except for his arrow quiver and a crown of oak leaves. He slowly fitted an arrow into the bow and drew it back. It was aimed at his uncle's heart. I screamed. Tom turned slowly and looked at me. Don't, I said. Don't! Tom held both the look and the arrow for another endless moment. Then he threw his head back and howled, and threw the bow and arrow aside and plunged into the still black water and crashed through it to the island. His eyes were closed and his mouth contorted with the cry which echoed on and on. Clay did not move. Still howling, Tom reached for him, hands curved into talons. I swung the rifle to my shoulder. I got Tom in my sights just as he reached his uncle and seized him in a terrible, strangling grip. In the mad, whirling moment before I tightened my finger on the trigger, I thought that he meant to crush Clay to death in his arms. And then I saw that he had buried his face in his uncle's neck and was crying huge, tearing, primitive sobs. Slowly, Clay embraced his nephew. I felt the earth drop away under my feet. I threw the rifle into the underbrush. The darkness whirled and whirled. Nausea rose like a cold flood. I heard over the wrenching man's grief from the island the morning birds begin their songs once more. Epilogue. It is Indian summer now. Goat Creek is not the same, of course. It can't be without him. I'm not a saint, and I'm probably not even crazy enough. I'm still never going to kill an animal. But I've done a little dancing and a little chanting out there, and Hillary is extraordinarily good at the old things. She has them in her book, The True Story of Tom Dabney. It was what she was writing down all those long days back in the summer. What she remembered of the old things, what she sensed, what Scratch told her. It isn't perfect by any means, but it'll do until Tom gets back. He'll come out of the hospital probably around Christmas. They've already said they'll release him into Clay's custody, or maybe even mine, like he asked. Of course, that was before they knew I'd quit my job at the college and moved out here. They'll probably think I'm too crazy now myself to take charge of a recovering crazy. A paranoid schizophrenic, I believe they said.
So it'll probably have to be Clay, at least officially. He'll do it. He'll spend his life trying to make up to Tom for all of it. Everything. He really was going to let Tom kill him that morning.
Oh, yes, he'll come out if he doesn't die from the water. I don't think he will. Not for a long time, anyway. Nobody has seen Goat Creek light up since they filled the pools. When he comes out, we'll be here, Hillary and I. He's right. I can see that. I don't understand it, and maybe I never will. But I know that he is right. There has to be a crazy saint at Goat Creek. If there isn't, a hole in the world will open up, and all the vows will leak out, and the woods will die. The wild will die. It was a very near thing this time. So we will stay and wait for him. And I will teach my child the things she has to know about the world, including the hard necessity for saints. That there are very few ever in the world, and we should honor and take care of the ones who accept the call to it. That sometimes, when we can, we have to stand in for them. I can teach her all that, and she can learn. She is, after all, my daughter. And my name, after all, is Diana.